Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
It is Dane here with you, high atop Chicago Skyline Studio on Sunday morning. And I'll be with you until 1 p.m. today on a cold and brisk Sunday. But we've got a nice show pulled together for you, an eclectic blend of guests. We're going to hit some of the things that you know and love on a weekend. And then we're also going to tie in some great food stuff, some different sports things. We'll get with maybe the Cubs in spring training. Some of the guests coming up right after the break we are going to have. So on the racing side, you know, WGN, of course, the first station to ever broadcast the Indy 500. And we are having the race, the NASCAR race, back at Chicagoland Speedway. Great history there, and excited as that race gets back there. So many fans are happy to be able to enjoy some of the things, not only the stuff that happens on the track with the biggest stars of the sport, but the tailgating, the camping, you know, all those things that happen down in Joliet. I know it's called Chicagoland. It isn't the closest to Chicago, but it certainly is beloved, and everyone is excited to have it back. When we come back from the break, we're going to have Jackie Herrera. She is now leading the way there, and she'll be able to share some of the excitement in store this summer. And then we're going to have Dave Schwann. He is going to share some of his favorite locations, one of his favorite destinations, reasons that you should go there, maybe some of the historical significance around that. We will talk also with Northwestern's Dr. Santina Wheat, and she is going to share measles are on the comeback. So if you're a big measles fan, you know, just know that they are not stopping, that they are coming back, and maybe in a town near you. She's going to talk about that, things that we can do to avoid them if we're not fans of that. And it is also, as March 1st, it is National Kidney Month. You'd think that would be every month could be Kidney Month. It's an essential organ. We're going to talk about that. We've got some things we want to share, and of course, Dr. Wheat will do that as well. As plus, you know, your thoughts on anything happening on the health side as well. Keeping it on the health side, Lou Weisbach. This is an individual who has worked with every administration in the last, I would say, 20 to 30, maybe even a little bit longer than that, years, including the current one, to try to shape some of the health outcomes with a whole new perspective of prevention and cures. The National Center for Cures. He's going to talk with us about that. Some exciting things are happening. Some initiatives are going into effect, and we'll talk with him. John Vincent, you know him as the voice of the Cubs in a lot of different ways. You know, there's a number of different people that take that role, none bigger than John Vincent. And with the Cubs heading down to spring training, he's going to share a little bit about that. Plus, he's also so close to Coach Dick. I know there's been some challenges there. Maybe he'll share some of that with us as well. David Hammond will be in studio. You know him from he's the dining and drinking editor for New City. And then also, we are going to talk with him about Chicago's beloved indigenous delicacies, things that originated here and maybe traveled around the world, or things you can only get right here in Chicago. So, and excited to have on the line a person leading the way at a place that is all, you know, both ways, brand new, but also with such a great history and tradition in the Chicagoland area when it comes to NASCAR and racing. She is the general manager of Chicagoland Speedway, Jackie Herrera. Jackie, welcome to WGN.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. I have to say, and I know that a lot of people were so excited about the NASCAR street race. It allowed, you look at the visuals that we had, the ratings that we had, the way it sort of mobilized the city in a bunch of ways, and just was something groundbreaking for NASCAR. Took it to places it hadn't been before. Very exciting. But there's also always been a soft spot for Chicagoland Speedway in the area for race fans, not only just in the Chicago area, it's Chicagoland, but the entire Midwest. And as you know, Jackie, NASCAR fans travel, and to have that opportunity to do all those other kind of things, which is, you know, the camping and the tailgating and just all of that family commiserating that happens when it comes to a race weekend. It's great to have Chicagoland back.
We're thrilled to be back. This is, you know, a lot of consumer demand from the fans. So we're happy to bring that back to the Midwest, to Chicagoland, and bring it to, you know, the community of Joliet.
Now, you think about this, and I'm sure you've heard all of that, is over the last few years, people would consistently email me and text me that it's going to be, there's going to be an Amazon warehouse, you know, right in the middle at the start-finish line, or it's already been sold to Walmart, you know, just all of these different rumors. But the track, the facility has been pretty much preserved, and that's exciting. So there must have been in the back of the mind, hey, this is one of those great position places in the Midwest. It's a track that has great racing. Whenever I talk to drivers, which is all the time. You know, they love Chicagoland Speedway. It is a great place for them to race. The sight lines are awesome for the fans as well. I got to share a moment with you, Jackie, and I go all the way back to the groundbreaking of Chicagoland Speedway, where you had a Bill French Jr. there. Remember, at the time, it was a collaboration with IndyCar, so you had Bob Jenkins, that legendary IndyCar voice. You had Indy 500 champ Eddie Cheever. And then on the NASCAR side, mentioned Bill French Jr., you had Dale Earnhardt Sr., Dale Jarrett was there as well. It was pouring rain. I don't know if anyone has shared, as you know, take kind of control of that great facility, has shared that, or maybe you were there. I don't know if you have you heard about that groundbreaking.
I've heard about the groundbreaking. I didn't know it rained, but it was, it's great. I mean, we have a lot of excitement. People that I just interact with in the community are always bringing up these neat and unique experiences that they had at the track. So we're just happy to be back.
Yeah, it was pouring rain. What they were going to do is, so then they had to tent it because they were going to have all of the drivers. They were going to have the drivers that were there, including Dale Earnhardt Sr., Dale Jarrett, Eddie Cheever. I think Scott Goodyear was there. They were going to get on ATVs because the track wasn't in place yet. You know, it was just sort of mapped out of where the track would be and sort of the configuration. And they were going to race ATVs around, but it was pouring rain, so it was super muddy, so they couldn't do any of it. But to see what it became, I think is really, really exciting. So, Jackie, as you're there to try to shape that weekend, and we know as much of the excitement that happens on the track, so much is happening around it. In the last X amount of years, NASCAR has had a real commitment to bringing in a lot of other elements to a race weekend, whether it's music, whether it's family activities, whether it's days of other things happening. What can we expect this summer at Chicagoland?
We can expect some exceptional racing. Historically, there's been great racing over at the track. We have musical entertainment coming. We're going to celebrate America's 250th. There's camping. There's vendors that will be in the fan zone. There'll be some activations that are pretty neat. So we're encouraging people to come out, have a great time, celebrate 4th of July weekend with us NASCAR style, and prepare for an incredible NASCAR experience.
Do you know offhand, one of the things that they did for the street race, and it, depending on the track, you know, they do different activities. A lot of people like yourself leading the way at our different tracks have a lot of autonomy on how they're going to do it. Do you happen to know whether there's going to be a family plan, or kids get in free, or some ways that people can start planning, you know, dollar-wise? I mean, entertainment in these days, it's something that you got to plan for cost-wise, and I know NASCAR is always thinking of that.
Yes, thank you for mentioning that. Friday and Saturday kids are free, and then Sunday kids are 50% off. So we have Friday, the race starts at 7 p.m., Saturday 4:30, and Sunday at 5.
And then, go ahead.
There's lots of family offers that will be coming, or different offers that we have available on our website, and that's chicagolandspeedway.com. Yeah. So we encourage everyone to visit and check out the offers.
Yeah, Jake DeGregorio, you know him very well. He's the one that coordinated this. He usually likes to kind of space out the exciting announcements. And so one of the things that you think, and if you're a racing fan and you see these top acts, you know, great performers on the music side out there, whether it's the pre-race concert, maybe it's even the day before, maybe it's part of the national anthem, especially for the 250th anniversary of the country. Is there anything that you can share, maybe like, you know, kind of tease maybe some people in the mix, maybe people you're considering?
I can say that we will be revealing some exciting announcements in the coming weeks. So check our social media, check our website, because all of that will be coming very, very soon.
All right. Okay. So close to the vest. I think that's good. You got to be very secretive, but it is early. It is March 1st. It feels outside. It still feels very wintry, but it is kind of spring-like as well. One of the things that I think is very exciting about the NASCAR situation last week, I don't know if you know this, but we had your colleague on, Latasha Causey, president over there at Phoenix Raceway, and she does an incredible job of bringing that's a great
she
facility
does.
As well. And excited, of course, Julie Giese is someone that's been very close to the station as well, and she was there at Arizona, and she was at Daytona, and of course leading the way here in Chicago for the street race. Just talk a little bit about it, Jackie. Just, you know, in a sport that has just felt very, I don't want to say male dominated, NASCAR has been very inclusive and progressive, and there's a lot of ladies leading the way.
There is. We have a few ladies at different tracks leading the way. I have been fortunate enough to work with Julie Giese over at the Chicago Street Race. So having this opportunity to move over to Chicagoland Speedway has been great. Just learning a lot from the ladies as well as the male presidents. And it's just been good learning on my end. I grew up a NASCAR fan, so it's always good to kind of have those nuggets of wisdom from people that have a little more skin in the game than I do, if you will.
Interesting to hear that, Jackie. You've been a NASCAR fan, just like Michael Jordan, our very own, you know, kind of indigenous superstar here. They were lucky enough to win the Daytona 500. And so he's so identified with Chicago, with sports, but also grew up a NASCAR fan. You wouldn't necessarily have thought that with his legendary GOAT status in the NBA and in basketball. But Jackie, so I mentioned a couple, you know, great ones back at the groundbreaking for the place where you're leading the way now, Chicagoland Speedway, Dale Earnhardt Sr., Dale Jarrett. But for you growing up, like, who were your favorite drivers?
Toner Stewart was one of my favorites. Jeff Gordon. So my dad introduced his three daughters to NASCAR. So Chicagoland, of course, was our backyard. And so for us, it was Jeff Gordon and Toner Stewart. Those were kind of the T-shirts that I had growing up, the memorabilia. So it's going to be nice to kind of, I've met Jeff Gordon already, haven't met Toner Stewart, so it's come full circle for me.
Toner Stewart is so much nicer than he was when I was a young reporter back in the day. He was, you know, he softened, I think, being a dad, right, and being, you know, just kind of on in life a little bit has allowed him to kind of just, there's a kinder, gentler Toner Stewart. If you were going to get to meet Toner Stewart, one of your idols, I would say now would be the time to do it, as opposed to years ago when he was, you know, he was oftentimes a little crabby.
And I think when I met Jeff Gordon, I did take a picture with him and right away sent it to my dad. And he's like, that's so cool. So it was really exciting to share that moment with my dad.
Last thing, and we're going to be talking about the Cubs are doing spring training, and we're going to talk some vacation destination. We're going to talk to some people who are experiencing food and travel around as people sort of contemplate, maybe they've already got it planned, their spring break trip that could be coming up. And for you, a lot of times the track presidents, you know, when I'll travel to different tracks, there'll be a number of them there. I don't know if it's sort of the, you know, like the League of Justice kind of thing where they get together and you guys have like a secret handshake, or you're just there experiencing what's happening at other tracks, best practices. Hey, we should do more of this, or maybe she should do that. So what are some of your favorites as you have gone around over the years in racing, whether it's a fan or whether it's one of these executives, and said, hey, if I ever get to take over a track, I want to do this. What are some of your favorite places that you would say Chicago fans should get out and see?
Besides Chicagoland Speedway, and of course the Chicago Street Course, I just came back from Daytona, my first time at the 500, and it's incredible what Frank and his team do over there. Our Michigan track is incredible as well. My team is going to have the opportunity to go visit and kind of see best practices like you mentioned. So just working with Joe over there in Michigan, I've been to COTA as well. Latasha does a great job over in Phoenix. And just across the nation, all our tracks do kind of great work. And put on great experiences. A lot of the fans want to come out, and I think that for me, it heightens kind of all our senses, kind of seeing the race fan, hearing the engines, the smell. It's just a great experience. And I tell everyone, you have to experience a NASCAR race for yourself.
Yeah.
To kind of see what it is.
Jackie, that's amazing that you mentioned that. We all know this stuff, but maybe we can brainstorm a little bit. There's like a think tank, right? On the thing is, I don't know if NASCAR has marketed the smell enough, right? Because it is a very unique thing.
The
smell of racing has its own appeal, and then of course the vibrations. You know, when you have all those cars traveling by, you feel it. You know, there's a visceral kind of sensation that goes with it that is part of the full experience, and that's why we say, as well as TV has done, and it's gotten so great over the years, there really is no. There's just no substitute for being there, to being on site, to experiencing all of it. And there's opportunities, you know, to get in and meet drivers and see the cars and the practices and, again, all the different events that you have. And so as we let you go, Jackie, give information where I don't know if tickets are available yet, but where they can go to get more kind of insight and get prepped up to see everybody out there at Chicagoland.
I encourage everyone to kind of just come celebrate America's 250th birthday with us, NASCAR style. Visit our website at chicagolandspeedway.com for tickets. There's different ticket offers as well. And enjoy 4th of July. Take in all the attractions that will be there, the food that will be there as well. Tickets are moving fast, so come join us.
We'll have links up at WGNradio.com for all of it. I know that WGN is broadcasting some of the races race weekend, so excited to be a part of it, as well as, of course, sharing all that fun for the fans. Jackie, we'll let you get back to your weekend, but thanks so much for everything you're doing. Thanks for jumping on the show today.
Thanks, Dane. Have a great day. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Yeah. So it is, you know, as people are planning, says we're going to talk with Dave Schwann with his favorite destinations, the far-flung situation. He's going to pick out some places. Maybe he's contemplating a race destination. You know, maybe not, right? He's always got, maybe it's George Washington. I don't know if George Washington raced, maybe a three-legged race. But Tony Dinar's our guy. When it comes to spring break, you're a younger guy. What does it mean to you? Does it mean sort of a South Padre Island feel, or maybe 10 guys in a hotel room in Daytona kind of thing? Because that was my spring break. But what was yours? What do you think is good?
I'm always a tropical guy, so wherever that is, Daytona, anywhere in Florida, anywhere I can get closer to a beach is fine with me.
Okay. And family wise did you guys take the family truckster vacations to any place like Disney World maybe?
Well, we've been to Disney a couple times. My grandparents actually used to have a condo down in Siesta Key, Florida.
Wow.
So we used to go down there every other year for spring break, and they were 10 minutes from the beach, and that was a great time, but definitely a ton of memories down there.
Very last thing, doesn't have to be spring break, but have you ever built a trip or vacation around sports? You're a sports guy, and have you ever said, like, okay, you know, if it's in Topeka, Kansas, maybe you don't go, but let's say the Final Four is in, you know, someplace really cool, maybe you go.
I'd love to go to the Final Four, but believe it or not, no, I've never actually planned a trip on sports. But like you mentioned, the Final Four, you're almost better off a lot of times just staying home and watching it, because you get up in the seats that are somewhat cheaper, but you're so far away from the action, you really can't even see anything. I don't know if you've noticed that before, because they'll fit 70,000 people in a basketball or a football stadium for a basketball game, and it's not the best.
Tony, this is going to be a teachable moment right here. Like, you're a media professional, and maybe a press pass will offer you a better seat to see and enjoy the action. And now it's time for Dave Schwann and the far-flung forecast.
Thank you, Dane. Good morning, everybody. Get out your compasses and protractors and newfangled devices, because we head to Christiana, Delaware today. Let me rephrase that. Christiana, Delaware. It's in the northern part of the state and is an unincorporated community, actually. The population, actual community goes back to the 1800s, but it's never been over 1,000 people. At last count, it was around 500. But it is also the home of a very pioneering African-American woman. We just finished Black History Month, this being March 1st, but we wanted to include this today because it was on this date in 1864 that Rebecca Davis, later Rebecca Lee Crumpler, became the first African-American woman to receive a medical degree from the New England Female Medical College. That was in Boston in 1864. She was the first African-American female doctor of medicine. What's even more astounding about this is this takes place still during the Civil War. She went on to serve African-American communities and also work in Boston, and has left quite a legacy. But she was born in 1831 in Christiana, Delaware, and on this date received a medical degree, the first doctor of medicine for an African-American female, in March 1st, 1864. Today, Christiana, Delaware... I said it wrong again. Christiana, Delaware. Sunny and 41 today.
I wonder, Dave, if they have pronunciation marks on the welcome to sign.
It's it's no fault of the town. It's me. Just getting it wrong there. Christiana, Delaware.
I love it when you share some of the individuals. I know last week it was, you know, George Washington, right? It was one of those where you have some pretty
Colonial
prominent
Beach,
people.
Virginia. Yeah.
Everybody's heard of him. We were trying to explore whether he went swimming, and, you know, what kind of, you know, swimming attire was available for, you know, generals of the Revolutionary War. Probably not very comfortable. I don't know if they even had elastic, right? It was probably heavy and wool. So we learn about things, but think about this. You know, when you shared her and just what she was able to do with being the first African-American woman to get a medical degree, with the challenges that existed, you said it was still during the Civil War.
Civil War was going to go on for another year.
And just imagine how motivated and how just either resourceful and disciplined and just you would have to be in order to do that with all those challenges. And I think that's great for people out there listening, thinking, hey, I don't think I can do this. There's a YouTube video that probably says exactly how to do whatever it is that you want to. But just think about that, being able to do that. So if you think you have challenges in your life, you know, she was one of those that really made the most of it.
Yes, she did. Yeah, Rebecca Davis was her given name when she was born. She was married twice. The first person was Wyatt Lee. So she became Rebecca Lee then, and then married soon after that a gentleman named Arthur Crumpler. So she became Rebecca Lee Crumpler throughout her life. But she treated women and children in Boston. Here is a woman remarkably ahead of her time.
Now, Dave, as you have traveled often, of course, you always share your trips, some of the road trips that you take. You and your dad traveled extensively. If you were going to, because I don't know that Delaware, you know, like I said, I don't know that their Visitor and Tourism Bureau is doing a great job in making it one of those sought-after destinations.
Yes, they are.
So what would you suggest if people
are
thinking? The beaches. Okay, the beaches in Delaware.
My girlfriend Gilda and I have been to Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. A gentleman by the name of Joe Biden has a house there, by the way. But Rehoboth Beach is a very popular summer destination. And then the town just north of it is spelled L-E-W-E-S, Lewis, Delaware. That's one of the oldest communities in the United States. In Delaware.
So you've got Delaware. And I know when I was a kid and we did sort of the family truckster thing up towards the, you know, we visited a few states because they're relatively small, you know,
yeah.
They're not Texas.
Oh, yeah. New England states are much easier to get around as you go south and west, the states get much bigger, as you know.
Yeah. And they were close together. So if you wanted to make a suggestion to people, hey, you're going to make sure to hit Delaware and some of these destinations, do you have like a couple others that you would say like, okay, and then you could hit here and here along the way? Maybe people make a week out of it.
Well, in Delaware, you know, the beaches, of course, there, but also Wilmington and the place I have not been to but want to go to, the DuPonts. The DuPont Corporation, the DuPont family has an estate there that I understand is quite the thing to see there. And, of course, as you get up into Connecticut and New Hampshire and Vermont, I think it's in New Hampshire, the oldest operating state capitol building goes back to the 1830s. It's still the original building.
Running water? These are outhouses for the governor?
No. But it was unbelievable. We walked into the building, a beautiful Senate chamber there, fantastic building. But we just walked right in. It's a rather small by comparison structure. And there was a guard at a table and he said, "Good morning." We said, "We're just here visiting from Chicago." And they said, "Sure, help yourself." That was the extent of it.
Well, Dave, we love it. The country has got so many great places, and you shed a light.
There's no end to the places you can visit.
This is a segment we always look for. You know, you got to be healthy. If you have your health, you have everything. And This Week in Health is sponsored by Northwestern Medicine. Excited to have on the line Dr. Santina Wheat. She's the program director for the McGaw Northwestern Family Medicine Residency at Northwestern Medicine, Del Nor Hospital. Dr. Wheat, welcome back to WGN.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you today?
I'm okay. I always think that's funny when you ask, you know, myself, and of course I think the listeners are thinking that too. You ask, how are you today? Because it's not just a perfunctory, you know, how you doing? It's more like, really, how are you doing? Are you okay?
Always.
Well, some people out there that thought they wouldn't be able to get one of those, you know, let's say you collect, you know, rare and extinct diseases, they would have thought measles was out of range, right? That had expired or was no longer available. But apparently it's something that people need to worry about. Again, I know in the news earlier in the year, we had heard about whether it's outbreaks in, I think maybe Texas and maybe some other places, a disease that some doctors had never even seen, are seeing more and more of, and it's now something to take very seriously.
That's absolutely true. And we've even had a case of it in Illinois recently. And so it is something that we hadn't had for many years. And then in the past couple of years, we have seen an uptick in measles, especially as more people are choosing to not have the vaccination. We're seeing it come back. And so it's especially something to worry about if you are traveling to any of the places that have had outbreaks, or if there's anybody around you that has traveled to one of those places. And so it is something to look out for.
When the kids, we have three kids, and so they've had to have, just for school, to get into school and being allowed to participate in that, they've had to have a number of different vaccinations, and they usually get sort of combined into just a group of things that are known and accepted, that these are things you don't want and you don't want to give to other people. She should probably get that. When it comes to measles, just your thoughts on that. As people that may not be, and most people, you know, they get their advice and their, you know, information from medical professionals. And I think vaccinations, especially the measles vaccination, is pretty universal. I mean, not even pretty. It's universally accepted that it has helped. And obviously we're seeing, you know, issues when you don't get it. Just your thoughts on that. And then how often does that happen to you where people are saying, well, I heard vaccinations are bad for you. What should I do? How do you answer people?
Yeah, so this is a vaccine that standard here in the U.S. we give at about 1 year of age, and then again at 4 years of age, with a little bit of a caveat that if you're traveling, you can get the vaccine early. So I tell my patients that I treat them how I would treat my own children, and even my oldest has had an extra dose of the vaccine that protects against measles because we went traveling when she was young. And so that is how I talk about it with my patients. I wouldn't do something for you that I wouldn't do for my own family. And I do see more people that are saying that they're concerned about vaccines. They're concerned about what is in them. They're concerned about if it really does help. And the truth is, when we don't know that they're helping, when we see that people are very healthy, that means that they're doing their job. We really want to avoid these diseases. We want to avoid our children getting very sick. We want to avoid them being in the hospital or even dying. And so I do have real conversations with my patients about this one in particular. We have seen some deaths in the past year from measles and would really love to prevent that.
Yeah, I think to get the word out of that, this is truly something that you definitely want to avoid. I think measles, I don't know, just my perception of when you think about it, you just think of it as, oh, okay, maybe it's along the lines of like a chicken pox kind of thing that a lot of kids in the past just all got. And that's how you got your immunity, was you had it. You know, you actually had chicken pox. But measles is very serious, right? It's one of those things that, can you share a little bit just about what it is that you get and then just how it can be so dangerous to certain age groups?
Sure. So measles starts very similar to any other cold or virus. It starts with respiratory symptoms. It starts with a fever, and then it often has a rash that covers the entire body. The problem with this is that last week we talked about encephalitis. Measles is one of the viruses that can cause encephalitis, particularly in the very young or those who are immunocompromised. But the problem with these viruses is, sure, many people won't get very sick, but you don't know who it's going to be that does get really sick. And so even someone who is otherwise healthy when they get the virus can be really impacted. And then I especially worry about those who were too young to get the vaccine. So I mentioned that you get it at one usually, but if you have a baby that's under 6 months, they're not eligible for it. And so we especially have to watch out for our youngest ones and then even our adults who are immunocompromised.
So we kind of set the stage. You know, now if we've got measles is sort of back and you've got to kind of watch out for it when it was just part of history books and stories from the past. Are there any other ones that are, that you're thinking, or you and maybe your colleagues in the medical field are thinking, okay, well, here's something we probably want to watch. Anything interesting, you know, like the bubonic plague, or I've heard polio, maybe that there's some things there to watch out for. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so the ones that we definitely know are rising, we definitely know that pertussis or the whooping cough, that one never really went away, but we have been seeing that one rise, which can also impact the very young and the very old, just like we talked about with measles. There are definitely concerns that we're starting to see polio rise as well. That one we know has some serious complications for people throughout their life and can impact their ability to get around. And the other one that people are really starting to talk about, worrying about, is meningitis. We are starting to see some meningitis again, and that can just have serious complications, especially even in healthy people. So it's not something that we can predict. And as vaccine rates go down, we are just seeing these diseases come back up.
No, I'm sure you'll keep listeners up to speed and apprised of what to watch out for, and maybe some ways to approach and get in on some of the best practices as we go forward there. One of the cool things about March, I mean, everyone's excited about it. We're getting so many calls in and people walking around with their, you know, Go Kidneys t-shirts and some signs and things like that. It's National Kidney Month. You'd think that would be every month. Kidneys, you need them all the time, right? It's not just not just only in March, right? But your thoughts on National Kidney Month?
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity to raise awareness. There's a lot of diseases that impact the kidneys, and a lot of the diseases actually really happen fairly silently. And so it's a good time to think about, are you doing everything that you can to be healthy? Are you having a low-sodium diet? Are you making sure that your blood pressure is controlled? Those are two of the important things that we can do to protect our kidneys and make sure that we're living happy, healthy lives.
Yeah, they don't get a lot of publicity. I think the Visitor and Tourism Bureau for the Kidney needs to get on the job on the marketing side and kind of promote it, because it is a very important thing. Personally, my brother-in-law has had two kidney transplants. Wow. And so he's had diabetes his entire life. And so over time, as you had mentioned as well, that's one of those things that damages it over time. And so then you can have to deal with it. And so he had to go on dialysis for extended periods of time, which by all accounts is really unpleasant. It's not a fun thing to do. And then he was able to get a transplant that lasted, I think, maybe about 5 years. And then he recently got another one. One of the things that I did not know that I'm sure a lot of the listeners were not, is that when they do the kidney transplant, they leave the old ones in. So when he ended up having an infection and a complication, they decided to go ahead and get the old ones out. I had no idea. I was shocked he had extra kidneys in there.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Taking the kidneys out can be a larger surgery than placing it in. And so it's true. Anybody that has a transplant usually has their previous one still there.
I mean, it's crazy because you have all these extra kidneys because you had to go ahead and get those taken out because there were some infections. And so the doctors thought maybe that was the right thing to do. On the other side of it, and this is something I'm personally having an issue with, is I have a kidney surgery on Friday. I've got a kidney surgery on Friday. Over the last few months, some pain, like back pain, and then some blood in the urine, but not stuff that you could necessarily see, but it came through on an annual exam, and then they did a few extra tests, and then they decided that's it. And so, which can be very serious. There was a musician from the band Three Doors Down that, and like you said, it happens silently, that ended up having stage 4 cancer, had no idea. And then that was like his first diagnosis was, hey, you've got this, and it's probably, about a year that you've got left to live. So I don't know how you can proactively get ahead of some of those things. Are there tests you can take? Mine, thankfully, is just a really giant kidney stone that's so big that it can't pass. So that's certainly unpleasant, but I guess positive considering the alternatives.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you have an answer and that there's a solution for that. And the biggest thing that I really watch out for is there protein or blood in your urine? And so if you ever notice that things look off, or you notice that there's blood, then that's absolutely a reason to go in. And as you get older, particularly if you have high blood pressure, that's something that we watch for. And it's just a reason to ask questions at the doctor. It's not necessarily something we screen for as far as renal cell cancer goes, but it is definitely something that we look for when people have symptoms.
And so if there's any things, because it's combining, so we're going to combine some of the topics here. It is National Nutrition Month again. Dr. Wheat, I know that you and I would advocate that Nutrition Month should be every month, right? That you shouldn't just be, they do have dry January, right? And you have some certain times so maybe you're even more nutrition conscious in the month of March. But so maybe if we can combine them, what are some good things to eat, drink, I guess, nutrition-wise, that are also good for your kidneys?
Yeah, so I think about the DASH diet, which is a lot of fruits and vegetables. It's lower sodium, and it's really about having foods that are fresh and not prepackaged when you can avoid it. And obviously, we can't all avoid the things that are prepackaged, but when you are doing that, making sure that you're adding to it with the fresh foods, eating, like I said, fruits and vegetables really are the name of the game when you can add that in, and then making sure you're getting enough protein. So really just a balanced diet throughout.
Balanced diet without trying to keep your blood pressure down, keep your salt intake down. Those are some of the things. And okay, so last thing before we let you go, people always say, they text in, they're like, what's Dr. Wheat really like, right? What is she doing? Since we're talking about spring break and travel, you mentioned that you had kids. Do you have a healthy destination, right? You wouldn't go someplace that was next to maybe a nuclear waste dump or someplace that would be not healthy, right? Even if it was interesting. Like, where does Dr. Wheat, where are you thinking of going? Now, of course, we're in March. I'm thinking of maybe it's going to be a little bit nicer. Where do you go?
Yeah, we do have a spring break coming up. We are planning a trip to Mexico City. We like to explore cities and see the different museums. So that's our plan in a couple of weeks.
All right. And we don't want to pry too much because we don't want, you know, all your fans to follow you to Mexico City. I think you're probably safe with that.
I think I'm safe.
Before we let you go, if you want to give information out or people to follow you, maybe social media wise or get a hold of all the great things happening at Northwestern.
Yeah, to find out at Northwestern, www.nm.org is Northwestern Medicine. And people can find me at my name on all of the social media places, but I go by Dr. Tina Wheat in most places.
Dr. Tina Wheat, thanks so much for everything you're doing. We appreciate it. Always great to share some of those health either tips or things that are happening, the trends, certainly some of these great days. Thanks for jumping on the show today.
Thanks. Have a great week.
All right, so there it is. Now you know. Now you know what to do. Don't you think, Tony, that like Nutrition Month, that they should just make it? How about can 2026 be the Nutrition Year?
I know, right? It's like, why isn't every year Nutrition Year?
You'd think. I mean, it's one of those things that you sort of need, unless you want to get like rickets or something. And I want to know when we can talk. I was excited. I look at the list every time, and sometimes it's just not timely. It's just not. But like monkeypox, you know, I was wondering if we could. When was the last time we even brought that up?
That is very true. And you brought up, was it polio? I think you said something before, too.
The bubonic plague.
I mean, that's how many, probably, what, almost 100 years?
Yeah. Well, that's like a kind of like a rock star kind of old school, you know, I don't know, like apocalyptic kind of disease. If you get that, you know, that's kind of a badge of honor, I would think.
Well, like you say, I mean, we have so many vaccinations now. And like you talked about, the importance of getting them. You may think you can't get measles or something, but like we saw, there's still a recent uptick in it.
You can. And the key, and you mentioned it, Tony, the key is to not get it in the first place. Lou Weisbach, back on the program. You know him as a sports guru involved in so many different things as a great marketer on the sports side and the venue side and a ton of those things, but also a crusader for health as well. And I was excited to hear from him about that unique perspective. It's unfortunate that it's unique that instead of, you know, focusing on you know, treatment, whether it's like surgeries or medicines or drugs or even some of the great cures that are out there, is to focus on prevention, not getting sick in the first place. Excited to have him back on the line. Lou Weisbach, welcome to WGN.
Well, actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk as much as I hate talking about myself. I'd rather talk about something that's equally important to you and your family and all of your listeners at the same time, and that is preventing and curing diseases, because the only reason we don't prevent and cure diseases isn't that we can't. It's that we have no business model to accomplish that. So people keep running for cures and walking for cures and throwing money into a system and a process that really has never worked. And there's no reason to think that it should work. And I'd like to draw the analogy to the Chicago Bears last year. And if you think to be successful at anything, you need to have the five pillars of success, which is you need to have enough money. When it comes to research, we never have enough money. We, even if we have a cure or a preventative element, we can't cross the finish line because they run out of money. So you need to have enough money. Number two, you need to have the right leadership. You need to have somebody who knows how to cross the finish line. So just think about if you had Tim Cook, the head of Apple, and he had $36 billion, and his only job was to wipe Alzheimer's off the face of the earth, we would all feel pretty good about that. So then you need the right business plan. Nothing succeeds without that as well. And you need accountability. And you're hearing from every politician right now about affordability and accountability. But you got to have accountability to be successful, and you need a sense of urgency. And what we've done in putting together the American Center for Cures is we brought all of those elements together to once and for all do something we should have done 30 years ago and wipe many of these diseases off the face of the earth.
Lou, here's the thing. One of the things I wanted to get your thoughts on, too, is it just the health landscape and what is out there, how has that changed, number one, or has it changed? Or maybe it's our perception and awareness. And some of the things that I mentioned is, you know, something like autism may have been happening in the past, but it wasn't as diagnosed. We didn't know as much about what it is. And so maybe it was categorized as something else, and maybe other things throughout history. And then also, too, with lifestyles, like, are there things that are just more prevalent now, issues, maybe congenital things that may come about, or maybe just things that happen that are different today? Maybe the challenges are different today than maybe they were 50, 100 years ago.
Yeah, that's certainly, it's a good point, and it's certainly a part of it, but it's not the real issue at the end of the day. I gave a speech in San Francisco at a Super Bowl event about this. I gave a speech at the Democratic National Convention about this. People in the audience were crying because people understand that it's a process issue. We don't have the right process to get the job done and across the finish line. So just think about this. We essentially wiped out polio 70 years ago. Does anybody stop and think that of all the money we've spent on research in the last 70 years, of all the new technology of AI, why aren't we wiping out diabetes, which is really the low-hanging fruit? Why aren't we getting rid of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's? It's not that we can't. We don't have the model that brings together all the elements you need to be successful. If Apple had, in search of an iPhone, had the same model that we have in prevention and cure, you'd be using a rotary phone, and I wouldn't be sitting here on my iPhone. Well, but I have to tell you something. It's not funny. It's disgusting.
Well,
and it's disgusting that we as a society haven't gotten together and said enough already. If you remember in the movie Witness, Harrison Ford, when he ended up kind of going at it with a corrupt police officer, he yelled enough. And Sean Connery in The Untouchables, which was filmed in Chicago, when they were trying to go after Al Capone, finally he turned to Elliot Ness and said, "What are you prepared to do?" And that's where we are right now in healthcare, because preventing people from getting sick and curing people is a 100% issue. It's not the 5% issue of men playing in women's sports. It's a 100% issue that affects not only you, Dane, and your producer, but everybody who's listening to this show, but every American in the exact same way. And we should have had enough by now, but we can't get the message out until the media is willing to tell that story. And I'm excited to be with you today to talk about it. I'm excited I'm going to be on The View in a week and a half and doing a lot of other national shows, because the time has come.
Well, the people would think that, you know, the people that are, you know, sort of jaded and cynical think, and you always hear this, that they don't want to do it because the pharmaceutical companies, there just isn't any money in the prevention side of it, because, you know, if let's say you need to have, you know, people need to get sick so that we can treat them. You want to do that successfully, but there's a business model behind it. As modest as you were not wanting to necessarily bring up all of the things that you've maybe done in the past in the introduction, you know, you've been a very successful businessman. So that's probably part of it, right, Lou, is just build in a business incentive so that people that are, you know, that have talented and have access to all of that technology or whatever is necessary to provide the prevention, make it worthwhile for them so that that's another goal that they can have to get involved and do things the right way.
Dane, you make a really good point. But let me talk about the pharmaceutical industry, because they get a bad rap. And they get a bad, and the perception out there is they don't want to cure anything. The reality is they're a business. And in their business, they don't focus on cures. They focus on treatments, because that's how they make their money. And they make all of our lives materially better. If you and your family or I, if we have some illness in our home, and we can go to any drugstore in America and get the most remarkable things that take care of our issues immediately. So let's give them the kudos that they deserve. But it is not their job to prevent people from getting sick, and it's not their job to cure people from getting sick. And it's nobody's job. And that ends now, and that's why we have created a model called the American Center for Cures, which will have $750 billion and 16 separate units.
Wow.
That are totally accountable and responsible to wipe Alzheimer's off the face of the earth, wipe Parkinson's off the face of the earth. I met with Michael J. Fox about this 22 years ago, and just think about where we are on Parkinson's today relative to 22 years ago. We've gone literally nowhere. And we've gone nowhere, not because people haven't tried, but because we don't have a process and a business-like model to get the job done. And so the American Center for Cures is going to provide that. But really, it takes all the American citizens to demand the funding of this, which ultimately will cost the government nothing. And literally, because whatever we come up with and the economic results of that will bring down the deficit and do so many positive things at the same time for our economy, and will ultimately make America the exporter of good health,
yeah,
which is what we should want to do. So,
what we want to do, and you mentioned it too, is you've got to have the right people motivated to go ahead and do that. You've got to have the resources, the dollars, and all of that, and of course the savings on the dollars. You've got to have a business plan. As a businessman, you know, I hate that you have to even say that. Like, wouldn't it be great if people didn't get sick in the first place? And there are a lot of things out there that are happening that we know, based on the resources, the technology, the capabilities of science and medicine, that we could get out there and make a huge dent in some of these situations on the health side. Some of these diseases, some of these afflictions that are happening, and that's your goal.
Yeah, it's absolutely not only my goal, but the goal of so many people who've gotten on board to this initiative. But at the end of the day, the only way this happens is if the American public stands up to members of Congress and the White House and says to them, you work for us, and we're tired of this country being so divided. We now have a single issue, but more importantly, a single solution that is the same for every American, black or white, rich or poor, Democrat or Republican. And you work for us. If you want to keep your job, this is something that you are, with a sense of urgency, going to get behind and pass the bill. And the bill is really simple. It's $750 billion, but having the Treasury sell bonds to get that money. So the annualized cost to the federal government in the first year is $6 billion. In the second year is $12 billion. The third year, $18 billion. And that money is going to come back in spades. Because for everything that we are successful with, let's just take diabetes as an example. If we wipe diabetes off the face of the earth, which is low-hanging fruit, and which is something we can get rid of, it saves the federal government annually, in today's dollars, $750 billion. Not to mention all the diseases that are caused by diabetes in addition to it, heart disease and many of the other afflictions that we have. And so what you're doing today by having this conversation is you're letting your listeners understand what should be done, what could be done, and how they can be a part of this to make that happen. I should also mention that our web address, which gives you more information, is theamericancenterforcures.org. But anybody listening to this show today would say that in the last 5 years, they've had somebody that they've watched die and suffer from a disease that, if we had done this 25 years ago, would not exist today. And that should be enough motivation to stand up and do what's necessary to make this legislation go through.
Well, saving the government money is one thing that would probably get them involved and interested in it. And you can see, of course, right, that there are things that happen. There's all of the cost for treatment that gets spent. And if you didn't have that, and you mentioned those compounding things that happen because of something like diabetes, when it comes to incentive, we talked about that on the business side for those companies, the pharmaceutical company, or whoever, the medical community that would have to get in there and come up with some of these prevention elements, or I don't even know what it would be, because I want to say the word cure, but what is the incentive, you think, for them? Would they get, so, hey, if you cure cancer, the government will give you X billions of dollars, and so there's an incentive to do it, as opposed to the typical we get paid to provide care model?
Yeah, so let me kind of walk you through that. So the way this would work would be, this would be in the private sector. It wouldn't be a government agency per se. And the motivation of the people would have enough money. And again, I'll go back to the head of Apple. If the head of Apple had $36 billion in a six-year plan to prevent and or cure Alzheimer's, and could hire, and this is important, hire whatever scientists he wants to hire, whatever people he wants to hire, integrate AI into the process, bring all the pieces together, we would feel very confident. But this is not to make money. This is to do the right thing for the American people. And at the end of the day, save the federal government trillions of dollars over time and bring down our deficit. And by the way, if you were to go on ChatGPT now, GPT, you would see that the American Center for Cures model, as they look at it, would increase the gross domestic product of America by $2 trillion a year. So what's beautiful about this idea is it's a solution. It's something we should have done a long time ago. We hold our politicians and our government accountable to around an issue that we can all agree upon, and it helps bring the country together and get people to work together, which we're also frustrated about, around an issue that will heal the country physically, but also politically. So the timing for this could not be better.
We're going to have links up at WGNRadio.com for all of that, the American Center for Cures. org. And last thing in about maybe the minute that we have, it's one thing to get companies or the business community motivated to do things, but also too is you don't want them seeing it as a threat and working against what it is that you're doing. So that's something to consider as well, is how do you prevent? It's one thing to get them to do things to help support the cause. It's one thing to get them to not try to obstruct your efforts in the process.
Yeah, well, let's think about this. So this happens to be something that works well for everybody. It works well for the patients. It works well for their families. There are no holes in this story. For the pharmaceutical industry, we're building a huge incentive in, because if we get rid of diabetes, that's a hole in their financial model. But we are going to license to them everything that we come up with a $750 billion spend on research that isn't preventative, that isn't curative. So we're building in a tremendous opportunity for them to have the drugs of the future without any research cost. So we understand the economics. This is a big boon to the insurance industry, but it's a big boon to every American company to take many of their best employees and have them live healthy 10 years longer.
Yeah.
and not have the associated healthcare costs that are a burden for companies, for their employees. So it works well for everybody.
Well, we're going to have links up at WGNRadio.com for that, as well as we let you go. A guy who is, you know, always a winner on the sports side and the business side, now creating health as a win-win for everybody involved, certainly the people and the companies that are involved in that process as well. So, Lou, thanks so much. Get back to your healthy Sunday, and I appreciate you jumping on the show today.
Thanks so much. Always appreciate the time.
March, the calendar, it flips. It's so much different. It's one of those. Is it the one that comes in like a lion, out like a lamb? I can't remember if that's this one or if that's April. I don't know exactly which month it right has those characteristics. But it's the kind of thing where, and of course, our weather's become unpredictable because of global warming. I say to people all the time, they're like, oh, global warming. So I said, it works for us. You know, if it makes it a little bit warmer here, that's okay. We don't have, you know, all of that winter. Tony, your thoughts on that? Because I'm always reluctant to give up our bad weather street cred card. You know, so when people around the country say, like, Chicago, I never stop them and say, hey, it's not that bad.
Well, you know, it's weird, too. Like, when you look at the calendar yesterday and you're like, it's the 28th, and you pull out your phone today and it says March 1st, you're like, March 1st, how'd that happen? But I don't know. I feel like when March gets here, though, it's usually a sign like, okay, it's going to start warming up. You kind of get that sense of springtime. Maybe eventually we'll start getting some leaves on the trees, but it's definitely a different feel than January and February, where it's usually bitterly cold.
As a sports guy, as you are, you know, baseball, it's, you know, spring training has started, so we're starting to think about it, contemplate it. People in branded uniforms are playing each other in warm places, but, you know, your teams, if this is your sport, and of course, around here, you know, Chicago is one of the great sports towns in the world. You know, people love the Sox. I would say many more people probably love the Cubs, you know, just because of maybe the media entity around them and the ballpark and stuff. And, you know, people get excited about baseball coming up.
Yeah, the Cubs, I would say, are always the strong pull. But I think, too, with March, even if you're out in Arizona or Florida, it's just something to do with the family or with friends, especially in warmer weather, to go out to a ball game. And it's spring training. You may not know a lot of the players that are out there, not necessarily the familiar faces that you're used to seeing during the season. But like I said, a sign of warm weather coming, and it's just something fun to do. And I know the White Sox have started out decently in spring training. Not a lot of, you know, expectations for them, at least in terms of being anywhere near the playoffs by the end of the year. But it's just nice to see them playing well and the Cubs with high hopes this year.
Yeah, so baseball, I think the expectations, the bar of expectation is, and maybe it's just for Chicago. If you're a Yankees fan, you're always thinking you gotta somehow get to the World Series and win it. But I think here in Chicago, you know, the White Sox have had their challenges. It is a great place to go and see a game. The food there is absolutely fantastic when it comes to the Cubs, just because of, you know, centuries of soul-crushing disappointment. There isn't really this expectation that they need to win. You know, it's still a good time no matter what. Of course, I think some of your people that are out there that are baseball purists say you might want to necessarily, you know, you got to focus on the Cubs. They need to win. You know, when they got to the World Series, I felt like it was the kind of thing that I don't know that I need them to win all the time anymore. I felt just it was just such a cathartic situation for them to go ahead and get past that. Eli, your thoughts on this? I know that you are that you're a Chicago fan, a Cubs fan. You've got sort of Texas roots, but your fandom transcends your location through history.
Absolutely. I go to Wrigley Field whenever I have the chance. There's nothing better when the weather's perfect here in Chicago to just spend a day out at Wrigley. You mentioned the food is fantastic. So even if the results on the field aren't the way you want it to go, there's always something to do over there.
Yeah, it is. Now, do you have any expectations? Obviously, you got to call as a sports guy, you've got to just report back on whether they win or whether they lose, regardless of what it is that's going on. Do you have any kind of expectations for the Cubs? You figure like, well, whatever happens, we're just going to tell that story.
Well, the season is already, it's very young. You know, it's that time of the season where we always say it's a marathon, not a sprint. But I would be lying if I said I didn't have a little more expectations for the Cubs this season, you know, making the playoffs last year, winning the series against the Padres, and then falling to the division rival in the Brewers. It feels like this year there kind of is that extra bit of urgency on Craig Counsell's squad to get that win of the NL Central, not get in as a wild card team and really compete as the contenders in the NL Central, not letting anyone else run the division there. So really excited to see when this season actually kicks up at the end of the month here, and just waiting for these games to actually count.
I love the rivalry side of things on the NFL side. You see the Bears and the Packers, one of the legendary rivalries in sports and NFL cornerstones, but it hasn't been for the last 20 years much of a rival, right? The Packers, you know, traditionally were a better team and they won, and to see the Bears come out and do that, it just really brings both fan bases alive when it comes to baseball. You always think traditionally it's the Cubs and it's the Cardinals have been the big rivalry. And the Cardinals, if you look at the trophy case, right, that case is a lot more full than, let's say, the Cubs. But now our neighbors to the north, the Brewers, that is, Eli, your thoughts? I think that is really, I mean, that's a great rivalry now.
Yeah, you mentioned it there with the Bears and Packers. It feels like that Cubs-Brewers rivalry just attaches itself to an Illinois-Wisconsin beef in a way, if you want to attach it that way. There's the collegiate level as well. There's that really fun, like, border battle type of rivalry that you get when you have the Cubs Brewers matchup, where they're not far apart from each other at all. It's the short drive from one part to the other. It's what made that that playoff matchup last year so electric on both sides. The crowd was into it on every single pitch. So if that has any indication of what we're going to get here in 2026, I'm really, really excited for it.
You get an opportunity to see the opening day can be chilly. It's always fun. It's
Absolutely.
Always festive. It's always packed, but it can be pretty cold. I've been to a number of those. If you want to get down to Arizona and see some of the spring training, I would definitely recommend it. It is a great opportunity to get down there, celebrate with fans, and you got some pretty nice weather before it becomes 120 degrees down there in the Phoenix and in the Scottsdale area. 720 okay, WGN high atop Chicago Skyline Studio, and excited to have on the line the premier tech personality on the planet, so loved for her visits to the Today Show, famously seen in the New York Times, USA Today, and of course right here on WGN as the host of Techishly. Jen, it is the one, the only Jennifer Jolly. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, typically you are traveling in order to do more, whether it's out to CES for round the clock things, or maybe out to do kind of sit-ins and demonstrations with all of our favorite stations around the country, or certainly network stuff. Now you are traveling, deservedly so, to do less, right? You're going to go and just kind of relax. That's pretty different.
I am headed to the Cook Islands for 10 days of nothing but R&R. And for me, that means I'm getting in the water the minute I get there, and I'll get out all pruny like, you know, 9.5 days later. I've never been there before, but I'm going with my best friend from childhood. It's her third or fourth trip. So I'm just going to do nothing, think about nothing except the next pretty colored fish that I'm going to see.
Well, you know, people think if they know you right, they know that you are equal parts on the cutting edge and also at one with nature. Do the languages of the animal world, you know, is it the tropical? You mentioned speaking with the fish, Aquaman style. Is that the same as conversing with the moose or the bald eagle that you typically do? I mean, do you have that same kind of affinity for maybe the warmer weather nature?
I do. I, like you, live in a fairly cold climate during the winter. And the way that I do that, and I'm okay with that, having grown up in Alaska and everything, is trying to spend at least a week on a beach somewhere at the end of February, beginning of March every year. It does so much for my brain chemistry and my overall happiness and well-being. And this year, I'm doing something that I haven't done in a really long time. I'm going at least 72 hours completely gadget-free.
What?
Which is, it's equal parts panic when I say that, and also, oh my gosh, I can't flip and wait. Hmm. But the idea here is I am really addicted to my gadgets, my smartphone, my laptop, being always on, being wired constantly, working as much as 20 hours a day every day. And there's a whole lot of research that uses brain scans before and after a 72-hour reset from a smartphone. And it causes 72 hours without your phone causes measurable changes in your brain's reward center and impulse control regions.
Wow.
It's basically a complete reset for your creativity, for your relaxation, for your dopamine. Constant notifications create intermittent reinforcement, and it makes us keep wanting more and more and more. So I am going to report, of course, on this, because of course I will. But I feel like there's so many of us who are just really burned out of being always on, constantly connected. So join in with me, and I double dog dare you to go 72 hours without devices.
Yeah, so you're not going to be interacting, but of course things are going to be interacting with you. Are you going to wear some sort of backpack-mounted monitoring device that's going to be able to report back with everything that you missed or maybe didn't experience, or how you've been physiologically changed during the time?
Okay, I'm going to tell you something that's going to blow you away. I am going to use a pen and a piece of paper.
My kids would be like, what's that? What is it?
Full analog. I hope I remember how to write. You know those calluses we used to always have on like our middle finger from holding a pen or a pencil? I've got to like strengthen that part of my anatomy again. I have to develop a writing muscle. So, you know, when I've done this in the past, I've written about it for the New York Times. I've done it. I've written about it for USA Today, talked about it on the Today Show, all the places. I've done this when I've gone home to visit my family in Alaska and kind of been forced to do it. So it really boosts your mental health in ways that nothing else that I've found can.
Okay, well, I think that's going to be great. But as you do that, I wanted to get your thought processes, because so much of what it is that you do supports, whether it's tech advances in parenting, right, in working, and all that kind of stuff. But the world of vacation, the world of relaxing has changed so much because of tech over the years. I remember when I say these things, a lot of kids, you know, that are younger, their eyes roll back like, hey, back in the day, like you were not able to book your own flights. You had to go through a travel agent. As far as learning about whether you're going to go to the Cook Islands or Hawaii or even Disney World, you needed to have a brochure. You had a travel agent that was there to tell you stories about, hey, this is the place you should go, right? And now, of course, so much of that information and exploration can happen. You can do it yourself because of technology, right? It's changed so much.
Oh my gosh, there are so many like sweet spot travel hacks out there right now. Some of my go-tos are, I use an app called Going, G-O-I-N-G, Going. It watches almost 1,000 destinations from O'Hare and Midway. So for Chicagoland folks, it watches all of these destinations where every flight takes off from O'Hare and Midway, and it sends you, you tell it exactly where you want to go, and you can even tell it how much you'll, like the max you're going to pay. It will send you an alert when the prices drop 40 to 90% below normal. So Premium members save an average of $550 on international flights, $200 on domestic. There is a free tier available. That is so worth knowing about. You can let price make your destination altogether. Google Flights Explorer, you go to Google Flights, you hit Explore, shows you a map of the cheapest places to fly from your home airport. I just did a search, Cancun, $600, but Lisbon, Portugal, $380 in the same week.
Wow. So you wonder, you know, as we have a generally huge listening audience, is that everybody's going to get in on it and it won't be a deal anymore. I just want to keep it to some of our friends, just some of our people that are listening right now, right? You don't necessarily want everyone to know.
Don't tell anybody else. It's our secret. Also, another great little travel hack to use tech for, book on Friday, fly on Tuesday. The old myth of booking on Tuesday, dead. Now it's book on a Friday, fly on a Tuesday. Flying midweek saves an average of about 13% versus flying on a weekend.
Wow.
One more thing, Dane, I want to tell you about the Flighty app, Flighty, F-L-I-G-H-T-Y app. It's a real-time flight tracker, so my flight is delayed, which is why my flight out of SeaTac, out of the Seattle Tacoma Airport, got delayed half a day today. And I found out about that before I got up ungodly early and got to the airport hours and hours and hours early, because it sent me an alert before the gate agent even makes announcements. So gate changes, delays, cancellations, it works oftentimes better than the own airline's app, which you should also subscribe to, sign up for. I guess you don't have to subscribe to it, but download it and keep track on it. Those apps really can save the day.
Just to be able to be tuned in. It used to be such a thing of mystery, right? You would get there, you wouldn't know. You just felt like a passenger on, you know, the good ship Disappointment. You never knew how to do it. You're traveling all the time, and the way that you stay connected on a lot of it, make some of these reservations, the apps that you're suggesting, of course, we'll have links up at WGN Radio, is through your phone. And that is a very difficult thing. When you want to switch from one carrier to another, everyone thinks, oh, maybe they're not all the same. In fact, many of them have different either capabilities or limitations, but you have been bravely deciding to change yours.
I have stepped out on a huge limb, and I have gone with Noble Mobile. This is Andrew Yang's company. We've had him on our podcast twice now, and it's really hard not to sit down and have a conversation with this guy and not do whatever he tells you to do, because he makes you absolutely feel like he cares about you. And I did all of the research, and then I switched from AT&T to Noble Mobile in November. So I've now lived with it for a few months. It is saving me buckets of money. The average person in America overspends on their wireless service by $85,000 in their lifetime.
Wow.
We are all overpaying. It is absolutely wrong. It's easy to switch over. Chicago area, super well covered for
Noble Mobile.
Sorry, the shuttle driver just drove up. I've got to ignore him for a second. Tell him we'll be ready when we're done with the radio. Yeah, so Noble Mobile charges you $50 a month, never more, never less.
What?
And it is pays you. It's the first carrier that pays you cash back for any unused data. It's completely unlimited. But if you don't go over 20 gigabytes in a month, which you won't if you mostly use your phone over Wi-Fi at home and things like that, you get money back. So I've been paying an average of between $30 and $40 a month for all unlimited coverage, everything. And then the cash back, they're banking for me at 5.5% annually.
What?
So it's built around this idea that you shouldn't be punished for putting your phone down. In a world where we're all talking about screen addiction, we're feeling that pull, this philosophy is refreshing. They also modeled it after Mark Cuban's cost plus drugs idea, in that there's no reason why you can't run a good, successful business and not, you know, gouge people so egregiously. So if you make the switch, this is another thing that I have going on right now, Dane. If you make a switch, if you go to noblemobile.com/jolly and you use my last name as your promo code, they will give you the first 3 months for $10 a month.
What?
So imagine, yeah, unlimited coverage for $10 a month.
Wow, Jennifer Jolly, not only giving us, you know, insightful advice on the, you know, cutting edge technology, things that we need to have, of course, providing us with all that information and entertainment with Techishly Jen right here on WGN Radio, but also saving you money. And that's absolutely That is absolutely crazy. You know, I'm usually resistant to changing on the cell phone side, but I think I'm definitely, I know some listeners are going to consider it too. So we'll have links up for that Noble Mobile. And of course, you put Jolly in as sort of your promo code, and then you'll have some opportunities there. And yeah. Andrew Yang, he would never steer you wrong. Right? You know, this is a guy that knows what he's doing.
No, he does. And he's just a good guy. He's like, he really does want to make the world a better place. He's, he ran for president. He did surprisingly well for nobody having really heard of him before. He told us on the podcast, he broke the news that he will be running for president again. So if you have not listened to the Andrew Yang episodes, there are two of them on Tech and Sleep Gen right here on WGN. I highly encourage you to do it. The guy is such a great thinker, really interesting man.
His campaign is probably brought to you by Noble Mobile, right? Not only forget about mail-in balloting. You need like mobile voting for the next presidential campaign. That is great stuff. We're going to let you go and get on your vacation. If you get a chance to share anything, we'll keep everybody posted with your adventures. Be safe.
My shuttle van driver just switched to Noble Mobile.
Everyone should. I think that's all happening. Andrew Yang is working customer service, right? You kept him busy. He's going to do a lot of switchovers today.
Dane, it is always so much fun to talk with you. I can't wait till the day that we just have our own tech show. Let's just do that next.
All right. Travel safe, Jennifer. And then, of course, again, we'll have links up at WGNradio.com. And have a great vacation. Thanks for jumping on the show today.
Thank you. I hope everybody else gets a great vacation, too. And let's all talk about how we unplugged afterward.
Yeah, it's great. Jennifer Jolly, she's working so much. A lot of the travel that she does, you know, to go to the Today Show or CES, she gets to do that. But it's nice to have her get out there and take a break. Excited to have. So in studio, we've got David Hammond. You know him as a good friend, longtime friend of the program and a lot of the things that we're doing. And so, David, I can hear you. So you're going to be just fine. So, Dave, welcome to WGN. I know.
Thank you, Dane. Always you're
gonna
good to be here.
You're going
to
be talking about a bunch of really cool stuff, not only the travel side. So you and I actually got to meet on a travel situation. Yeah. We were reporters in
Virgin Islands, in
the Virgin Islands in St. Croix, talking about whether it's the food scene and some of those things. And you consistently travel, not only because one of the things that people don't necessarily know about you, they know that that you have an affinity for the food and drinking, but they don't know your bravery, right? And so you were in Mexico, of course, battling the cartel.
Yes. Profiles encouraged, starting me.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to tap into the sort of the bravery side of Dave Hammond when we come back from the break. He's going to, and you know him too. What is the official name of the book? I always think of it as, you know, the Indigenous Delicacies of Chicago.
Too long. No, it's Made in Chicago, Stories Behind 30 Great Hometown Bites, where we examine like 30 foods, maybe three or four you've heard of, but another 26 foods that, even if you lived in Chicago all your life, you don't know they started here.
So, Dave Hammond, you are in studio with us. And, of course, people know you as the former dining and drinking editor of New City, right?
Was
it? And then, of course, you know, the Tribune and the Sun-Times and all the different things that you've done over the years. Let me see. I'm trying to see if I can turn down there we go. We at least can turn that down a tiny bit because we've got Highway to the Danger Zone. Top Gun. Speaking of which, coming up after the break, we are going to talk with the American Legion Boys State Program, where the next generation of Top Guns are going to be learning about, you know, some of those things. And when you think of a culinary Top Gun, I think of David Hammond. And before we went to the break, I mentioned, you know, we know all about the food side, certainly the Chicago food side. We're going to talk about that. But, you know, the bravery that you have to go, because you do travel quite a bit. And it isn't, you know, you're not going to Disney World, right? You're going to, you know, you're not always going to like war zones, but sometimes a war
always
breaks out wherever you are.
Yeah, well, just last week, a week ago today, in fact, Carol and I walked out and went to our favorite little carnitas place in San Miguel de Allende, this little joint down the street. I mean, it's a hole-in-the-wall place with a woman behind there serving the carnitas and a couple of Mexican families having lunch there. And as we walked out, I saw Carolyn walked right by this armored personnel carrier. There were guys with automatic weapons, National Guard, guys with automatic weapons. They had a hood, like a roof-mounted machine gun, a big thing, you know. It was like for a war situation. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Security is pretty tight here. Then we got back to our little house we were renting, and we found out that there had been major disturbances in Jalisco on the water. And Jalisco, is a neighboring state of Guanajuato, which is where San Miguel Allende is located. So it was kind of close by, but it was like to the edge of Guanajuato, was like a which is where the disturbances were in that state. It was like a 7-hour drive from San Miguel. So it's like if something had broken out in St. Louis, you probably wouldn't be that upset, you know, you wouldn't worry about it. But the streets were pretty much bare Monday morning. Everyone was advised to stay in your house. School was canceled. They didn't, because they just didn't know what was going to happen. We saw some scary stuff on television. But here's the interesting thing. A large percentage of that was BS, was fabricated news. The cartel itself, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel.
You want to give appropriate credit.
Yeah, right. In case I ever have to go back there, I don't want them getting on
me. Hey, guys, I did mention
your brand is all over the place. They were putting up fake news on Instagram and Facebook to make their revolt look bigger than it actually was, although it was big. The biggest part was they were blockading roads going in and out of Puerto Vallarta and some other cities, and that's where it touched on Guanajuato. There were some roads blockaded. There were like 85 blockades in 20 different states. And this American couple told this story where they were driving their car, cartel guy stopped them, told them to get out of the car. They got out of the car, gave him the keys. He didn't hurt them at all. In fact, I haven't found any evidence that any Americans were injured. The stats say one civilian was injured. I'm guessing it was a Mexican. Anyway, they took his car, set it on fire, and blocked.
I hope it was a rental.
I hope they
bought the insurance program.
I hope they got their luggage out. So that's what they were doing. They were taking cars, lighting them on fire, and blocking the highway, which meant if you wanted to get somewhere in like Jalisco, it was a crapshoot. You might get through, you might not. The odds that you would be hurt by the cartel seem to have been rather slight. But as I say, no Americans that I know of, and I Googled around for it, were killed in this fight. There were like a couple of dozen cartel members and a couple of dozen National Guard and like three Army guys. So, you know, that's very unfortunate. But when I saw pictures of the Guadalajara airport, people fly out of this country in a couple of days.
Yeah, you can't swear on the, you know, anyway. So
sorry, I got carried away with my narrative
with the battle that happened there. It's one of those things. So the cartel, and you're mentioning maybe it's a kinder, gentler situation on the cartel side, but also whenever you talk to people, they say that they're so integrated in a lot of the different things that are happening is that the cartel is almost I don't want to say as big a part, but a part of the daily life, a part of the government that they would have. So does the cartel have uniforms? Are they just dressed up as...
Well, as a matter of fact, I did see this Jalisco New Generation Cartel had branded jackets that said...
like the Thunderbirds or something?
Well, they had the name, you know, the JNGC or something like that on their jackets.
Wow, okay.
On their flak jackets that had, you know, munitions in there. They have rocket launchers. They're getting American arms in there.
Yeah.
Military grade American arms. And so they're well equipped, probably better equipped or more extensively equipped than the police department down there.
It was interesting to see how, because usually those tourist areas, I think everybody agrees, regardless of what your position is on crime or their position that, you know, within the community or what their role is that you want to leave the tourist trade alone because it is just so important to the country. Yeah. And if you were going to try to prompt the government, which I'm guessing if they really wanted to, they could do something about it. If it was messing up, you know, the major, you know, finance of the country with the tourist side, like they'd have to step in and do something. So I think everybody agrees that's off limits. But I think based on what was going on and this person that was killed, the cartel leader, as bad as he may be, they probably tried to make a statement saying, hey, we can mess up the tourist situation if we want to.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was a statement. And that's why I say they were on Instagram and so on, putting out fake news about how big it was. They wanted to make a big splash, get people scared, and then they went away the next day. It was kind of like a very brief shock and awe sort of thing. And then by Tuesday, schools were open again, stores were open, people were walking the streets, no problem. But it was scary. Something I found on
Were you actually scared? Because you travel to a lot of these places, and I've spent some time, you and I have spent some time in Mexico together, where the cartel and those elements were at least a part of the thought process, where we had a security team and stuff.
Well, remember when we went by that shrine to Santa Muerte, and I wanted to stop? This is the skeleton saint of Mexico. And the driver, I could tell, did not want to stop. And somebody had said they had found two heads there the other day in front of that shrine. I think I would put money that was a cartel incident because cartel is heavily
I mean, there's working serial killers there.
Well, Santa Muerte is the saint of the narcos. I mean, she's big among the dispossessed and outliers in society. Was I scared? I was with my wife, too. I mean, when I'm alone, I tend to be...
So you had to act super...
Yeah, I mean, I didn't
even braver than typical.
Even braver than normal. Right. The heroism, you should have seen it, Dane. It was wonderful. The town people, they were applauding when I walked by. They couldn't believe it. I wanted to go down to the carnitas store and get like a kilo of carnitas to get us through this siege situation. Yeah. But Carolyn wanted to go with, so we... Both walked down the street, and I saw a woman out holding her baby. A guy went
by. Was the baby arm, David?
It seemed kind of, the streets were deserted, but the people I did see were very calm and seemed to be unconcerned. Nice. So I just took that. And there was it turned out there was no reason to be concerned. San Miguel Allende, pretty well, pretty secure community, and, there were no incidents in that town.
Excited to have on the line as part of our Veteran Voices series, and for people familiar with the programs and the features and the podcasts, we highlight great either personalities or programs or situations related to our men and women in uniform. And it's great to have on the line with us a guy that is leading the way. Illinois doesn't always get as much credit as maybe it should for leading the way, but when it comes to the Boys State program, the premier Boys State program, and of course Girls State as well, as being led by Christopher Benigno. He's the chairman and executive director. Chris, welcome to WGN.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity, Dane.
No, it's always great to talk to you and have you on. I always say, and you and I both agree, that Boys State maybe doesn't have as much exposure as it deserves, right? And so it's always a great opportunity to be able to share what's happening, the program, the benefits, just the opportunities, especially now we look at in light of what's happened over the last day or so, as far as shaping that next generation of people who may go into the service, it's important to share.
It is my favorite topic.
I mean, as it should be. So let's talk about the program for those people, the uninitiated. Of course, I'm familiar. You were instrumental in being a part of it. My son Maxwell attended it and got so much out of it and was so excited about it. Now he's out at West Point as well. So it can be, something that can be instrumental in a lot of different ways. Civics, politics, there's so many things to know and learn.
Absolutely. Our preamble to the Constitution for the American Legion, a line in there is to inculcate a sense of individual obligation to the community, state, and nation. And that's what we instill in these young men. And it's just a fabulous program. We get a lot of parents that call us afterwards and say, what have you done to my son? He has never been like this. So driven and dedicated and he has manners now.
I don't know, Chris, if you're making some promises that we can't, your results may vary. I guess we'll do an asterisk. Not everybody's going to get manners, but what they will get is they'll be kind of pulled out of their shell and they'll be they get to experience really government. In a lot of ways from the working side of it that you don't necessarily have. And of course you have the military side of it as well. Talk a little bit about what kids experience when they're there.
Sure. So the only aspect of military is we teach them how to march, just because we want to get them to point A and point B. And, when all the poobahs come on Thursday night for the big assembly night, they're doing a ceremony for them. So the program started in 1935 by three legionnaires. And they started this program because of the anti-American youth camps that they saw popping up in the United States. So that's Hayes Kennedy, Harold Card, and Matthew Murphy. It originated at the Illinois State Fairgrounds in Springfield. We now hold the program the second week of June every year at Eastern Illinois University.
And explain to us how people can get involved. So it's a week-long program. It happens in the summer, and you get all of these. It's an immersion, right, into civics in a bunch of different ways. How do people get involved and participate?
Yes. So it's a learn by doing structure. So the young man only has to go to our website, go to the registration page, and register. If they know their local Legion post, they can put that post number on that registration form. So we contact the proper Legion for sponsorship. The cost is $400 for the week, but the Legion will take care of that. So any families out there that can't afford it or want to use their money for something else, we'll take care of the kids. It's their first taste of college life because they're in a dorm. We have them for a week, and it's a week that shapes a lifetime. They get so much out of it, and we have some introverts that are extroverts when they leave, and they just have a fabulous time. The only boys that say that anything negative are the boys that never went. You know, I wish I would have known. I wish I would have went. Anybody that goes to our program is ecstatic, and they make lifelong friends. They get a automatic membership to our alumni association, so they can keep up on things, all things Boys State, and it's just a fabulous program. The experience alone, and this year's the 250th birthday of our nation, so we're going to have a little celebration there as well.
Yeah, so just an additional reason to get involved and be excited about it. As listeners are hearing some of this, maybe some of the kids that may want to participate, we're going to mention, too, that girls, there's a Girl State program, too, so that they're including in this. But if they're thinking, well, I don't know, how am I qualified? Like, what are the qualifications, or what do you need to have in place in order to attend?
Sure. The only two qualifications are you must be a junior in high school going into your senior year, and you must be interested in going. And sometimes the parents will tell the boy that they're interested in going. We hear that a lot. My mother made me come, and then at the end of the week, they don't want to leave. They've had so much fun and learned so much and made good friends that they say the experience is priceless.
So share, Chris, if you could, and let the listeners know we're talking with Chris Bonino. He is the chairman and executive director of the premier Illinois Boys State program, of course, Girls State as well. The dates when it is, and then where people can go for more information in order to find out, get signed up, and be a part of all of it.
Sure. Our dates this year are June 13th through the 19th, and Girls State is the following week after that. They're both held at Eastern Illinois University. All you need to do is contact your local post or just visit our website at illinoisboysstate.org and go to the registration page. There's all the information on there that you need, what to expect, what to bring, transportation if it's available in your area. Not all areas have transportation. The Alumni Association, the experience you're going to have. We give out $20,000 in scholarships every year. We have 12 scholarships that these young men can win, and that's certainly going to help to better their future and help them move on.
Yeah, they get so much out of it. The teamwork, you know, you get that leadership development, you get that experience, like you said. And I know Maxwell has got friends that he stays in touch with since that day, since those days, right? Since he came back, he still is texting those guys on a pretty regular basis. And so it's a great program. We'll have links up at WGNradio.com for all of it. Last time, Chris, if you want to give the website out one more time.
Yes, Illinois Boys State, that's plural boys, .org. IllinoisBoysState.org.
Okay, we'll have links up. I appreciate it, Chris. We'll let you get back to your weekend, but thanks so much for everything you're doing, for your service, of course, and for jumping on the show today.
Thank you very much.
All right. It's a great program. David Hammond in studio with. And so some people, their association with the American Legion isn't necessarily, you know, it's a local place. And on the food side, you had mentioned, I didn't think it had anything to do with the Boys State program, but maybe the food selections at some of the places that one of them had raccoon. That cannot be. Was this in the Northwoods somewhere?
Every year it's the Dan McNulty annual raccoon feed. And we went.
But we're feeding on the raccoons?
Yes.
What?
That's
horrible.
Well, and this is USDA approved meat. They're growing these
I'm okay with it.
Yeah, good. Now they're cultivating these raccoons for their fur, which they send to Eastern Europe.
Make some great hats, yeah.
Right, coats and so on. And then they have all this meat, which they usually feed to horses. But once a year, you can go to the American Legion Hall in Delafield, Wisconsin, and get. And now it's a blow. You can't get tickets anymore.
You can't because it's
a year or two in advance. Well, people love the raccoon.
Now you let me know that it was in Wisconsin. That's even more concerning. I thought maybe Arkansas, Mississippi. But in studio with us, we've got he's the former dining and drinking editor for New City, and you know whether it's the Sun Times or the Tribune, a lot of other publications around the country. But one thing they can never take away from you is you are the perpetual, the always author of your own book, which explores the indigenous delicacies of Chicago. Before we went to break, listeners will know that we brought up raccoon, and you sort of made a case. I don't think you were credibly repulsed by what.
Oh, not nearly.
What you were describing is you mentioned lines around the block. I was wondering why, but then you mentioned Delafield, Wisconsin, and maybe they march to the beat of a different drum, maybe a hairy, vicious, rabid drum.
Well, we were talking about the Dan McNulty annual raccoon feed, and that's a one time a year event.
Yeah,
we went and there was.
Is it special? Like
now
Halloween,
you have to.
Right?
It's crowded now. It's hard to get tickets because it's such a weird thing to do. I think it attracts people, and it's like I don't know, $20 for a platter of raccoon and some greens and stuff. It's
what pairs well with
pairs?
Raccoon? Well, and you mentioned
Jack Daniels.
Any other amnesia or mind altering substances? And I think maybe it's because maybe there's just not a lot to do there. So if you could have anything, you have any other random like activity that they may say, like, well, let's do it. Why not?
I think it originally started with this guy, Dan McNulty, who hunted raccoon.
He
had a bunch
fan.
Of raccoon. He thought, what the hell? We'll have a little luncheon at the VFW lodge. Then it grew and grew and grew, and they started sourcing raccoons from raccoon farms where they cultivated the raccoon for its pelt so they could sell it to people making fur coats and fur hats and so on. They had all this meat left over, which is USDA certified for human consumption, but it usually went to horses or livestock.
The typical thing is it tastes like chicken, right? That's the thing that you always hear?
It was kind of like stringy beef. Wow. It had the characteristics of pork that is kind of stringy.
Okay,
but
like a pulled pork?
Yeah, kind of like that, only it was dark meat, very dark meat, which you'd kind of expect from a critter like a raccoon. living in the water, you know? A lot of fat in that meat.
And a lot of garbage, too. You think if you are what you eat.
These are
wild.
They started well. Now they're farmed, so they're probably fed, you know, pellets of some sort.
Oh, so they taste like
that. Does that sound better to you?
I don't know. They taste like pellets. So you mentioned the sort of a stringy beef. This is not. You wouldn't be writing menus, apparently, David, because like a stringy beef-like substance.
Well, I'm not really endorsing it. I mean, it was okay, but it wasn't like super delicious, and I can't wait till next year to get my raccoon on.
Well, you know, the season tickets, it's one of a waiting list, right? It's more of a lottery situation in order to get to participate. So when it comes to the eating of them, I feel like, based on what you've said so far, it would be more of a sort of a pulled pork bun kind of situation. Or were they doing little steaks or maybe putting it in a stew?
It was more like pulled pork on a plate. I mean, it looked like very dark pulled pork on a plate. there's a lot of fat in a raccoon. They got to stay warm in the water.
Were there souvenirs? Like, I survived the raccoon feast?
They did sell T-shirts. Yeah, I didn't get one. But, yeah, they had it's a thing. In Delafield, Wisconsin, it is a thing.
One of the things I thought was normal. It was a normal thing that you would do. But I felt like it was kind of disturbing. Even at a place as common and popular at a Red Lobster, right? When you can maybe say that the lobsters are oblivious to what's happening around them. But where you would go and you would... You would choose them.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's the guy that's going to get eaten. Now, raccoons, I think, I don't know where the intelligence totem pole ranks them, but I feel like if you're picking them out, like, hey, you, like, I would be trying to hide under Larry or around the corner, or just trying to avoid being chosen. Do you choose your own raccoon?
No.
That guy.
But When we were in Mexico, Carol and I were in Mexico in like the late 70s, and we were on Isla Mujeres, which is right off Cancun. Cancun was not Cancun then. It was just like a little village on the water. We walked into the restaurant. They serve rabbit as their specialty. The opening hallway is lined with rabbit cages, and as you walk in, you choose the bunny you want to eat for dinner. Now, that comes as...
It sounds disturbing. The therapy you'd need if you were as a child. Hey, honey, pick out a rabbit.
Oh he's cute. We'll eat him.
The plate shows up. He's like, where's Fluffy? He's right there. Dig in.
Enjoy. Yeah, that was kind of skin crawly, creepy. But we did it.
Yeah, well, you get the fricassee, right? You've got your... I don't know. I'm not sure about all the
rabbit
all
stew.
The culinary.
Elmer Fudd loved it.
Yeah. Well, in some cultures, there is a history. I don't know if Delafield, if it qualifies as a culture, other than maybe just, you know, rural Wisconsin and maybe in need of other food choices. But when you think of Peru, you're a guy that's.
It's not like they're in, you know, I mean, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. They have
I don't know if the reason is good, except for this. This one guy, Dan McNulty, happened to have maybe more raccoons than he needed,
yeah,
and a pile of meat and some sort of relationship with the bar, and decided, let's do this.
I imagine this guy is kind of Grizzly Adams, just covered in skins and stuff, and with a shotgun over a blunderbuss over his shoulder.
You need a shotgun for a raccoon. It's more like a...
Boy, you got me. It doesn't seem like it would take a lot to put down a raccoon.
So as we examine and sort of... kind of build in the world traveler side of David Hammond. In Peru, you have guinea pigs. And so my kids, my daughters, and you know them, you've met them, they had guinea pigs. They love their guinea pigs. They would be shocked and horrified to have a guinea. But in Peru, they eat guinea pigs a lot. Now, here's the thing, is it isn't just like, okay, well, it's that meat. What's the difference? They actually have the pictures on the menu of the guinea pig with a little hat on it.
So, isn't he adorable?
Yeah, so they're really leaning into the cuteness of the animal while they're eating. And I don't know if you can do both. You know?
Well, if you go along 18th Street in Pilsen, they have carnitas places where they're serving this like stewed pig meat. There are many pictures of happy pigs in pots boiling away, other pigs cooking pigs to make carnitas. It's weird.
So yeah, that makes me think of, and when we come back from the break, we're going to go into some of the real indigenous delicacies. I'm sure there could be others added. You know, maybe as a new species of invasive animal shows up, maybe we get creative with it. But if we'll remember, I'm sure listeners will remember as well, the commercial for Moo & Oink. And I remember as a kid watching the commercial, and really the way it was, Moo & Oink was the, you know,
yeah,
and there's a theme song, and the animals were dancing. It was a person dressed as a cow, person dressed as a pig. They were having doing a little dance, high five, and I always, as a child, thought it was strange because they're about to be murdered and eaten.
But they
seem,
but they don't know it or don't care.
They seem really okay with it. You know, we are highlighting some great food opportunities, some great food places. Some maybe not so great, but for those adventurous people that want to live off the land and have raccoons, maybe that's what they want to do. If they want to live and enjoy, feel very Chicago with their food choices, there's nobody better than David Hammond to help shepherd them into the wise and oftentimes delicious ways of Chicago food. So, Dave, welcome back.
Good to be here, Dan.
So when you guys put this book together, and it has been a success, I'll have to take, I don't want to say all the credit, but I know that early on, like, you shared your thoughts, your ideas for it, and then you brought in food veteran Monica Eng as well, and to do something that hadn't been done before. Now, we know that we are very proud of Chicago, you know, whether it's our sports teams, whether it's, well, political corruption or other things that we're identified with, but also this is a great food town. Certainly, James Beard Awards are here. Some of the best restaurants in the country/world right here in Chicago. So it was a natural place to do that book.
I think the number of little neighborhoods in Chicago, ethnic enclaves, that are developing the foods of their homeland or taking the foods from their homeland and modifying it for Chicago audience, or just making something they think is pretty tasty, like the Italian beef, which started on Taylor Street in Chicago at Al's Number One. For our book, I interviewed Chris Pacelli, who's running Al's Beef right now. His father and Al Ferrari started Al's Beef, it was called Al's Barbecue at first, as a front for a gambling operation. Chris told me this.
That's very Chicago.
It is, isn't it? And in fact, Chris Pacelli told me, and I couldn't verify this, so I didn't put it in the book, but he said a lot of these little Italian beef stands sold beef in front, ran numbers in the back. That's the way they did it.
Full service.
Yeah. get lucky. So that's Italian beef, and the giardiniera was like something that they have something like that in Italy, but it's made with vinegar and it's big chunks of like cauliflower and carrot. What we have in Chicago and called giardiniera is different. It has peppers in it.
I love the backstory, and you guys go into all of that and kind of telling that story. It's one thing to have something that people like, they enjoy the flavor, they try to eat it, and maybe it catches on, right? But when you have those backstories, you brought up sort of the, you know, sort of that foam crime side of the Italian beef thing, but also its humble roots, right? Because it was there for weddings and group.
Yeah, peanut, you know, weddings.
Yep. Just an opportunity to go ahead and have something that was good, that felt satisfying, nourishing, you know, but then feed a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Cut the beef really thin, soak it in gravy, soak the bread in gravy, and you have a hefty little snack at your wedding.
Yeah. So, okay. So there's some things that happen because of whether it's necessity or because, you know, maybe a front for your criminal enterprise. Either way, Italian beef has caught on. It is around the country now. And I will always say, you always have people from Philadelphia. It's not my favorite city. You know, they'll talk about the cheesesteak. And I'm like, it's so much better than the cheesesteak. The cheesesteak is just heavy.
What's bad? I'm not going to slam their cheesesteak, but I don't think the cheese is very good. I mean, it's not cheese.
It comes out of a can.
Frequently,
if
something
whiz
like
is
that.
After the cheese in the word, maybe you could do better.
But that Italian beef is a good example of a Chicago original food that's spread across the country. I mean, now you can go to L.A. or New York, and they'll have. Usually call it Chicago, like at a Chicago place, like Old Chicago Food Stand or something, they'll have Italian beef there.
And it's even gone across like the ocean, right? I think I saw you and maybe your wife were in Paris or France or something, right? And wasn't there
Chicago hot dog is
oh,
what we
hot
had there.
Dog, right?
Yeah, I was coming back from lunch one day right near the Louvre in Paris, and I saw a sign for a Chicago hot dog and realized, I got to stop and see how they're doing this.
They did. Did you go there as a hungry person to enjoy something familiar, or were you there as a critic to say, excuse me, this is wrong?
Oh, it was so right, I was amazed. Oh. That hot dog, it was an excellent wiener. They had the spork peppers on it, which really surprised me, because the French are not big on chili heat like that. The bun, however, was fantastic, because
Paris, they're way better at that.
They're Paris. Yeah, I think the only possible criticism I could have is that it wasn't crappy enough to hit all the right buttons for Chicagoans.
We don't, the celery salt and everything?
They had celery salt.
Wow.
They had the glow-in-the-dark relish on top.
Wow.
I mean, they really did a darn good job of it. So
we've got a few of these foods at Chicago. And Chicago is a working-class town with the stockyards and everything about it. And I think there's a romantic attachment to just our roots, right, as that. But there are some that are, I don't know if I consider them like super fine dining, but like a shrimp Dijon. You know, some of these are chicken Vesuvio, right, that have not only become popular, but also, you know, on the menus of some pretty high-end places.
The shrimp Dijon came to Chicago via the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893. As did a lot of items. I mean, that it was kind of like a World's Fair, although it wasn't called a World's Fair at the time. It was a great proving ground for a lot of foods that we now kind of take for granted, like Cracker Jack, Wrigley's, spearmint gum, and so on. And also, shrimp Dijon. The Dijon brothers came over from Belgium, had a little booth at the World's Fair selling shrimp Dijon. It was such a huge success that they opened a restaurant, Dijon Brothers Hotel and Restaurant, in Chicago, on the strength of their shrimp.
Wow. Those were pretty big deals at the time. It was like, what would you compare it to if you had to describe those World's Fairs? Because those did change, whether it was the world's awareness. We didn't have CES, like Computer Electronics Show, right? We certainly didn't have the internet or anything like that.
Nope.
So if you were going to have something that, hey, there's something new, something groundbreaking, something big that is going to happen, like you would have it, you would debut it at a World's Fair. Like the entire world, it was like the Olympics for new ideas, new foods, business, that kind of stuff, and it happened here.
They brought so many foods and other artifacts from all over the world. Gamelans from Indonesia, these plaster casks of Mayan, like stone replicas, they set up there. And I'm convinced that those Mayan buildings that they set up influenced Frank Lloyd Wright, in his, who visited the World's Fair, actually worked at the World's Fair, and after that started doing buildings with flat roofs, just like you see in Yucatan in Mexico. And music and other cultural forms were represented at the World's Fair, and that brought distant lands to Chicago for, I don't know how many months it was open. It was open for quite a while, and people were coming from all over the United States and North America to see this amazing collection of artifacts from other cultures.
I always think about it. Whenever I mention Chicago, people say, well, what's the food scene like? I always say, you could spin the globe, put your finger down, and there is somebody here doing it at a high level here in Chicago. So you think you bring the world here, a lot of it would feel that there would be some familiar elements to it. So I just feel like that would be very at home. So, David, as far as, you know, maybe a couple other selections from the book, you know, share that people would know.
Well, another, here's a food that's been around for quite a while, but I'm guessing very few folks on the north side are familiar with it. This is more like a southwest side thing. It's called a big baby. It's served at like five or six different little unrelated drive-ins called Nicky's. Now, if you can believe
that's
it.
That's the other Nicky's. Really?
Yeah. Were they
unaware of each other?
It seems like at one time they were related, and this guy Nicky somebody started them, and then he sold them to different people. So that's why, I mean, it's not quite as crazy as they all just happened upon the name
like
Nicky's.
McDonald's. No, we're McDougal's.
So they started serving this thing called the Big Baby. It's stunningly simple. It's basically like a two hamburger. You have the bun of the hamburger. On the bun, on the heel of the bun, that is the bottom part, you have your condiments, mustard, ketchup, pickle coins. Then there's a burger. Then there's cheese.
Like a traditional beef patty burger.
Yeah, like a 10 to 1. Like you get at McDonald's, the smallest burgers. Then there's another patty on top of that. Then griddled onions. It's that simple.
The big part? Because you mentioned it was called big. But, of course, babies are small, so even a big baby
story goes that the originator of the big baby, which was this guy, Nicky somebody, I forget his last name, he was working with a lady, and he called her a big baby, and she said, I shouldn't be the big baby. You should name your new hamburger the big baby. So he named this hamburger creation the big baby after sexually harassing one of his workers in the store.
Wow. So the origin stories can come in all shapes and sizes, right?
Well, we tried to give the stories are interesting. What we found as Monica and I have gone around the city, we've done like close to 70 of these presentations.
I've seen
the
them.
Book.
People love them.
And because people have been eating these foods a lot of their lives. You get a lot of older folks. I mean, people 50 and above. People who've been around for a while have had a lot of these foods, or maybe just three or four of them, and they kind of wonder, well, how did these foods come about? And we tell them how they came about in the stories.
Food can, you know, it doesn't always have to take the form of advocacy. It can be a cautionary tale as well. And there are things that are associated with Chicago. I mentioned, you know, political corruption or rampant crime. Right? These are not good things, right? But we have a romantic attachment to it. So Malort is the kind of thing that, like, we have it as a badge of honor. I guess that if you could tolerate it or maybe enjoy it, right? But it's one of those things that, you know, you sort of threaten people from out of town with.
Well, the joke is, I think it's Chicago's greatest in-joke. I mean, somebody, the deal is, someone comes in from out of town, a friend, a relative, whatever. You say, you have to go out to a bar, you say, well, can I buy you a shot of Chicago's signature spirit? Which Malort is. And so they take a shot of Malort, and then you take a picture of them, post it on Instagram, hashtag MalortFace, and they will join hundreds of other photographs of people having their first sip of Malort. Now, I think it's actually mellowed a bit over time. I bought my first bottle of Malort in the early aughts just to see what it was like. And, it's a type of bitter, if you like, kind of like Jägermeister. Right. Although I would say perhaps not as subtle as Jägermeister. It's now being made by this company, CH Distillery in Chicago, which bought the name and the recipe from the woman who had owned it for years. She was the secretary to the guy who carried on the Malort tradition up until like,
is there a Jebediah Malort? Like, where did they get the name?
Well, Malort means wormwood in Swedish.
Oh, nice.
And wormwood is a bittering agent in many bitters, and it's in Malort, too. That's why people make the screwed-up face. It's a bitter, if you don't like bitter flavors. And bitter is a pejorative in this country. They say, oh, that wine is bitter, this is bitter, that can't, whatever. Bitter is valued in many cultures as just another flavor. And so Malort is a bitter that's very, and bitters themselves are very popular in Scandinavia, in Germany, in parts of France, and Italy. That's where I first had my first bitter.
Now, of course, we're going to connect with them. In studio, we do have David Hammond, of course, writer of Made in Chicago, all of the favorite indigenous delicacies of Chicago. When it comes to your favorite indigenous vocal delicacy, right, your favorite when it comes to the friendly confines and setting that stage with the just amazing national anthems. And, of course, you can sing almost anything else, too. We've got John Vincent. John, welcome to WGN.
How are you, sir? Good afternoon, I should say now.
Yeah. No, it's good afternoon. It's great. It is great to have you here. And one of the reasons we wanted to talk with you, obviously, it's always great to get with you, John, and see what it is that you're doing. But now, as everybody sort of gets back into the mindset that the Cubs are coming back, it is going to be summer, your spring training is happening. How do you prepare for this? Is there ever like a spring where you get to March 1st and you're like, I don't know if I can do it again? Or are you always excited for the season?
Always excited. I leave tomorrow for Mesa. I'm going to do the national anthem when the Cubs take on Team Italy on the 3rd. So that's out in Mesa, and I'm 100% Italian. My parents both born in Italy, so that's a huge honor. I'm going to sing the Italian anthem and the USA anthem, so I'm ready for spring training. Every time of year right now, it's like Christmas for me. It's like, I'm ready. Here we go.
Well, you know, Chicago is a melting pot. We're talking about it on the food side. America, right? That's our whole backstory is, right, everybody coming together. When you have that opportunity, though, and you've got sort of the John Vincent origin story with Italy, and do you feel like maybe you need to give a little more maybe oomph to the Italian national anthem, maybe hang back a little bit, saying like America's got all sorts of, like Italy really deserves to shine here? Is there any sort of vocal conflict going on?
No, it's actually, I mean, my dad used to join me and would sing the Italian national anthem at a lot of events that would ask for me, John, can you do both anthems? So I would always bring my father to do it with me. So now that my father's been, you know, with Parkinson's dementia, unable to, and on hospice, and he's just a fighter. This guy is like unbelievable. It's been 2 years now. He's just so strong. It's actually given me something to work on inspirationally and everything. So I'm going to be thinking a lot about my dad, obviously, when I'm singing. And that's going to mean a lot to me for Italy. I love Italy. It's my roots. So it's going to be a special day.
Think about this, is when it comes to sports, I don't know that there's a tailgating, of course, for football is big. People think about that, but I don't know if there's any foods that are totally associated with it. But when you come with baseball, there are foods that are linked historically to it, whether it's the Cracker Jack, whether it's the hot dogs, whether it's that kind of stuff. John, yes. your thoughts as you get into there, and you know, you perform at, I don't want to say one of, I think it's the most iconic sports venue for history and tradition and Americana and baseball. Are there things that, are you one of those guys, just a traditionalist, or are you out there, you know, there's always some new thing, you're doing sort of the nacho surprise. I don't know. What is it that you like at the ballpark?
I'm not going to lie. Ever since the Ricketts family took over, and Mr. Ricketts and Laura Ricketts and everybody there, Tom, everyone has been phenomenal to me. They opened up the baseball park to me. So I've got to really experience the 1914 club, which is unbelievable. And the food in there is like, you know, it's Levy food, and it's some of the best food you're going to get. So yes, you get your hot dogs, you get your brats, you get everything else, but then you got like the wood-fired pizza and everything else, and, you know, prime rib, and they just went all out. And the best thing I love about Wrigley Field and what they did to it is everybody's like, oh, well, they put these signs in here, it's going to take away from, like, you know, old Wrigley. Everything, and I'm a homer, I'm not going to lie. I'll be there opening day. I love my Cubbies. I've loved my Cubbies since growing up on the south side of Chicago. But you cannot tell me what they did to that stadium, how beautiful it is. It's become a destination, and people our age and above can really remember the old days. When you go there, there's only a few options. Now you have everything, not only inside of that park, but around it.
Yeah.
And the food has become really like leaps and bounds. You got a small Cheval in there. You know, I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, they take it seriously, you know, even in the sports venues in a lot of different places. You know, you just have to step up your game a little bit. I wanted to ask you before we let you go, and of course, we're going to wish you the great travel that you're going to have to get down there and sing for whether it's, you know, spring training and that kind of stuff. Is so identified with the Cubs. I think you sort of crashed onto the scene maybe in the biggest possible way on that biggest stage for the World Series with the Cubs. But it doesn't necessarily define you in ways that people can enjoy what it is that you do and John Vincent. So back in my early radio days, I was part of the Chicago Sinatra station. And so we had to have all the Sinatra songs and things. And there is nobody better than you to be able to do those songs, do them justice. So maybe share that with you. Like, where can people see you? Not, of course, Wrigley Field. We know that. But where else can they see you and enjoy everything you do?
My next public performance, I want to say, is March 27th at Cafe Beyond. And I'm just saying that because I've been traveling and doing corporate events all out of town, and that's kind of what I've been doing. And I stopped really doing a lot of public shows. But that will be, it is, March 27th. I'll be going back into that. And I'm going to look to start doing more and more public shows. But I've kind of found this niche where I'm doing a lot of corporate events and private events, and that's where I'm booked up with, and just came back. I just did one in Palm Springs for the 250th anniversary of America at the Four Arts Center for the Four Arts in Palm Beach, I'm sorry, Florida, which was really cool. And then I'm going out right after the Cubs anthem. I'm going out to Duke for Coach John Shire and singing Duke, North Carolina at Duke on the 7th. So it's been a lot of corporate stuff now, which is different from me back from my Ditka days, and I do miss that. I do miss that. Like, I kind of miss that public singing, and I want to get back into that because the one thing that's been nice is I've been able to help my dad and do this because obviously corporate pays better and all that other stuff, so you get kind of spoiled with it.
So you want to go to Wrigley Field. Obviously, you can get a chance to see you there. And then what you want to do is you want to find where John Vincent is performing, and you want to get a job at that company, you know, because they'll have benefits, a 401k plan, maybe insurance. But if there's an occasional John Vincent concert, that could be a recruiting. That could be an recruiting incentive. So John,
you got me right there. You got me. That was good, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, hey, you know, there's a lot of intangibles in the employment landscape these days, and sometimes benefits are, you know, a little bit different than maybe than you would think. As we let you go, John, we'll have links up at WGNradio.com. Where can people go social media wise or your site in order to get in touch with you or see where you're at and go?
John Vincent Live. Instagram's my big one. Right there, John Vincent Live. And I'll post usually everything on my stories and everything that's going on there. And, I got pretty lucky. The year's pretty much booked up on, you know, major dates. But there'll be dates where I have that are public that I will post there. So, yes, John Vincent Live on my Instagram is the best place to find that.
We appreciate everything you're doing, especially this year with the 250th. I know, so patriotic. We know you'll be involved in so many of those celebrations around the country. And thanks for everything you're doing. Travel safe. Go Cubs. And thanks for jumping on the show today.
And thank you for being so flexible. You've always been such a gentleman. I really appreciate you. You are the best, my brother.
All right. Thank you, John. All right. We are going to take a break. Dave Hammond is here. We're going to have, when we come back, we're going to have Jim Bob Morris on. He is the founders of El Bandido Yankee. You just came back from there, so you can give sort of an assessment of the troubles down there. And, of course, some of the non-troubles, right, that are maybe just
mostly
AI
non-trouble,
generated.
Yeah.
It isn't just food that you talk about. It's sort of spirits as well. Sure. And you've you've walked that walk. Not only have you tried El Bandido, you've been to the distillery, and you've had you were one of the first ones, one of the very, very first ones to try the Añejo when it first came out. Mm-hmm. So you're obviously familiar with the brand, and we wanted to mention, we're trying to get a hold of Jim Bob Morris. He's an elusive character. He's probably off on a jet somewhere. He's like riding antelopes. He's
riding antelopes.
Well, he's always doing something, say swimming with tiger sharks or whatever. He does that kind of stuff. But here's a way to get involved, and whether it's maybe tickets to some of the games, maybe it's Chris Chelios, who's also one of the co-founders of it, of course, beloved Hall of Fame Blackhawk. some signed Chris Chelios stuff, game tickets, race tickets. Obviously, we're involved with a lot of the racing stuff. Scotty Hamilton's going to be joining us in a second or a little bit later, too, as well. And so if you want to get in on some of that stuff and El Bandido merchandise, you can email, just email in with your contact information, elbandidowgn@gmail.com. So elbandidowgn@gmail.com, elbandidowgn@gmail.com. Just kind of put in maybe what it is that, you know, your contact information, so we can get back to you, because periodically we're sharing, whether it's Chris Chelios autograph stuff, whether it's tickets to some of the games, whether it's race tickets, whether it's El Bandido stuff, of course, for people 21 and above, because that's the way it is. But opportunity to get in on, as you know, David, in addition to what's inside the bottle, there's a lot of fun and exciting stuff happening with the merchandise too.
Oh yeah. Tequila is, it's fair to say, the national spirit of Mexico, and more people are going down to Mexico and seeing how awesome it is. And tequila is the drink you have there.
Some of the potentials as tequila's hit its stride here in America, and it's one of those things where more and more people, it's become, I think the last few years, it is the most popular drink that's happening. And a lot of people are going to be drinking it in Daytona. I know that Tony right now is getting a hold of Scotty Hamilton, who's running Daytona Bike Week down there with El Bandido Yankee. As it's kind of spreading across the country, as you travel the world, it's you know, there's still a lot of, you know, ground to make up for tequila. It isn't as popular or as known, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in Asia. There's a lot of new fans to be made.
And it is growing in popularity, even in those countries. I mean, they can grow agave, the plant that gives tequila its sugars that are turned into alcohol. Grow that in South Africa, in Australia, in Auckland. You can grow agaves anywhere that it's hot and dry. Wherever agaves are growing, you can create tequila or mezcal.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? Of course, Lou Bank is one of our mutual friends, and he's a guy that is, does a lot on the mezcal side as well. And he does a lot of the philanthropic things because it is such a part of whether it's the histories, but also the economics of some of those regions. Like, what do you like? I mean, if you're a guy who can appreciate whether the historical significance of Malort, but also, you know, enjoy the tequila side and what it means. Do you like, I personally like mezcal. There's a lot of people that love tequila that say, I'm not a mezcal person, and the other way around.
A lot of people don't like mezcal because they say it's too smoky, for the same reason some people don't like scotch. But mezcal doesn't have to be that way. I mean, tequila, the agave hearts are frequently steamed, so there's no burning of anything involved, so it doesn't have a smoky flavor. Mezcal is frequently, in traditional method, is the hearts of the agave are cooked in a big fire until the sugar and the sugars start going, and then they crush it and ferment it. You get a distillate, and then you got your tequila or mezcal. There's a lot of mezcal that isn't smoky, and I honestly think of smoke as almost a defect. That is, it takes away from the inherent flavors of mezcal or tequila for that reason. One thing this is not a plug for Bandido at all, but when I was visiting Bandido, I was taken by what seemed like the handcrafted attitude of Doña Rosa. I forget her last, Rosa, I think is her name. She was
Karina Roja is the master distiller,
Roja,
right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, she was really seemed like a person who had lived tequila all her life. Her family may have been involved in it, and she's committed to making a really fine tequila by hand. I have no idea if now El Bandido is made in a large factory-like facility. I kind of doubt it is.
Nope.
That's good. It's because what I got there was the same kind of vibe I got from these little guys making mezcal way up in the mountains. I went up there, go up with Lou Bang. We're driving along these, dried-out riverbeds, getting to some little mezcalero in the middle of nowhere, making incredible mezcal that never sees bottles never see the outside of the town.
From the culinary tourism side, like Lou Bank, as far as being sacred, right? That's his charitable foundation that uses the promotion of mezcal and some of the spirits in order to support some of the families that are involved. He's been really great with that. I mean, that's Lou is one of those, you know, that he's one of those really great people out there. That doesn't, that also has, you know, really good things to share as far as on the tequila side and on the mezcal side, but also that higher purpose built into a lot of the things that he does. And so it's always really great to have Lou involved with some of those things. But when it comes to culinary tourism, and he's always trying, I've been wanting to go for years, but something, and it isn't just survival, right, that really prevents me from going with him, because you described the danger of what it is that's happening.
Well, Lou was actually down there recently when I, same time I was down there, but he was going to the Exploding Hammer Festival, which this is the weirdest thing. You can find him on, you can see him on YouTube. These guys in these villages,
Exploding Hammer,
they pack explosives around like the head of a hammer, and then they slam the hammer down on the ground and it explodes. Big noise. Guys are getting blown, they're hammering down, they're getting blown backward by the force of the explosion. It's a festival. It's the Exploding Hammer Festival. Why do they do it? It's traditional.
Sounds like the kind of thing you got to sign a waiver form for.
I sincerely doubt that any of them do that.
Eye protection, at least, at the very least.
Their lawyers standing by to take the case. No, it looked really amazingly dangerous, but people loved it. I wanted to go down there. It was too far away from San Miguel, but...
Yeah,
would have loved to have seen that.
On the line, we've got a guy that is involved in so many things on the racing side for El Bandito, but in a place where you've got is it hot bikes, and you've got maybe some cool, like, ladies situation, certainly cool cocktails, right? With El Bandito. I know I feel a little off color saying it. We've got Scotty Hamilton. He's down at Daytona Bike Week. Hey, Scotty, we've got about a minute or so to kind of share what's going on. What's all happening down there as you're breaking out the Bandito with the bikes?
Hey, Dane, how are you today? I am, I'm almost voiceless because this place is amazing, but I'm at the 85th annual Daytona Bike Week. I'm set up at the Broken Spoke Saloon in Ormond Beach, and I'm set up with Rusty Wallace and his whole crew with Southern Country Customs, and we are mixing bikes and the Bandito.
Oh, it doesn't get any bigger than Rusty Wallace. You think of him as a NASCAR guy. Listeners are going to say, hey, he's a NASCAR guy. But he, with Southern Country Customs, like him and his family, his son, they have got just some really great custom bikes that they're making and providing for people. And you got, and of course, we've got a couple of them.
Yeah, we've got one right now, and we're in the process of building the second one. They're all out on a big ride right now with Tony Stewart and his wife, Leah. They left about 10 o'clock this morning, and unfortunately, we got too many people that like the Bandito, so I couldn't go.
Well, that's all right. We need you here to be able to, you know, carry the torch on the promotional side for what it is that we're doing. So we got to go to break. We wish we could have got you like a little bit sooner, but it sounds like your voice can't handle it anyway. But thanks so much for everything you're doing, Scotty. If you're down in Daytona, I've heard WGN Radio on my car radio in Daytona, so I know the signal gets down there. Get out there, give Scotty a high five, and definitely break out the Bandito. Thanks, Scotty.
All right, thank you, guys.
We finally caught him. He is an elusive target, and good to have the man behind so many of your favorite brands, certainly your favorite tequila, the original Bandito. It is the one and only Jim Bob Morris. Jim Bob, welcome to WGN.
Dane, how are you, buddy? I'm coming to you live from down here in Florida, where it's a balmy 86 degrees. My biggest stress of the day was choosing between SPF 30 or SPF 50.
I know you're bathing in vitamin D. You mentioned that.
I'm bathing in vitamin D, brother. How are you?
I am.
How's the weather there? About 28 degrees?
No, it's really cold. It's like 25, maybe. I don't know, but it is March 1st, so people are thinking, hey, they're thinking fun, and they're thinking thoughts of maybe it might be a little bit warmer in the coming time. You know, spring training's happening down there with the Cubs. But here's another thing people are thinking. When it is March, you think March Madness. Jim Bob, I know that you're making out all the schematics. You have that command center there where you're trying to figure out which teams are going to get to the Final Four and the big dance. I know Juana Parlay's got that ready to go.
Absolutely, buddy. I will tell you, I'm still, you know, for all the Illinois fans, my man Brad Underwood and me, I'm telling you, I still like Illinois to have a shot, buddy, this year. I think that Illinois has a legitimate shot. I think that obviously, you know, the Big Ten is playing some great basketball. You got, you know, Michigan, the Wolverines are going to be there. I mean, the blue, you know, the old Blue Devils are always there, but it's going to be great. you never can rule out, you know, the Huskies either. I mean, my gosh. I mean, they're always up there. But I like Illinois to have a real shot this year.
Well, you don't have to necessarily know the teams yet, right? A lot of it's going to play out, but you can always do on Wanna Parlay. Fans of WGN, and of course, the Bears doing very well. You know, Wanna Parlay was shared in a bunch of ways during the NFL season. And so when it comes to basketball, it's another way to do it. For those people that are hearing about it and thinking, well, I like sports. I want to try to pick things. I want to try to win. How do you go about getting involved with Wanna Parlay?
First of all, you know, you just download the app. I mean, go to Wanna.com, go to Wanna Parlay and download the app. And then, hey, you want to put in $5, we'll match it $5. You want to put in 10, we'll match it 10. You want to put in, like Dane, big spender Dane, he puts up $250 and then we have to match $250. I mean, I got those big whale guys like Dane out here that want to go, well, I won't put in $250. You going to match that? And I go, of course we will. But, you know, you get on it and we've got the alternative odds now. So, like, let's say that the Chicago Bears are favored by, you know, -6. You know, you can take those odds now and take them down to -5, -4, -3, -1. You can take them even up to +1, make them, but, you know, the payout changes if the Bears are favored and stuff like that. But, you know, I encourage everybody to get on Wanna Parlay and experiment with it. You know, last week we had a big winner. A guy took us for $270,000. And I get calls on stuff like that, you know. And then, of course, our bankers are shrieking when that happens, Dane. Or, my gosh, he took you for $200,000+. Yeah, well, I mean, that's how it goes. We do have a bunch of winners.
Well, that's why you got to be big spender Dane as opposed to big winner Dane. You know, you want to keep me in the spender side. Okay.
Absolutely, buddy.
Jim Bob, before we let you get back to the hot tub filled with Anejo, we want to talk about El Bandido Yankee. It is so, it is the official tequila of game day, of course, of Tequila of Togetherness, the red, white, and blue Weber Agave. When it came to the Olympics, people were celebrating. Chris Chelios was breaking out the Bandido for all of that kind of stuff. Just, you know, your thoughts as we let you go, how people should celebrate with El Bandido.
Well, first of all, if you break out the El Bandido, you break out the Bandido today, it's the only thing bringing some heat to Chicago today, brother, is the El Bandido Shaggy Tequila, the smoothest tequila that Chelios and I came up with. I'll tell you what, the Plata 47 that we did is the new high proof. It is considered...
Nope. Oh, no. Oh, we lost him. Well, I can continue that thought. It's great. It's very good, and it's available at a lot of different locations.
What is it, Dave? Plata 47?
Plata 47. It's a high proof. So it's one of those high proofs that is over the normal sort of 80 proof that you typically have. I think it's like a 94 proof, 47% alcohol, and it is one of those things that is pretty great. You know, and it is doing well. It's winning a lot of awards, and so don't just take it from me. Take it from everyone else as well. Excited. We'll just naturally transition to a guy who knows. He definitely knows El Bandido Yankee, and he definitely knows things from around the world. He typically has traveled. Like Dave Hammond, you travel all the time. Hudson Lindenberger, one of the leading voices on the spirit side for Forbes, and he is calling us from New Zealand.
Awesome.
A place that is very cool. Hudson, welcome to WGN.
Hey, Dane, how you doing?
So I'd be remiss. People know you oftentimes as, you know, Forbes spirits writer, acclaimed, award-winning, all that kind of stuff, but you are also the host of really one of our hottest podcasts here at WGM, Booze News, and this is that opportunity for you to get into those long-form conversations highlighting not only some great spirits, but also some of those personalities and backstories behind them.
Yeah, you know, it's something I enjoy doing. I've always enjoyed telling the stories about alcohol and spirits behind them, and it kind of parlays perfectly into my existence of I like to travel a lot, and I love nothing more than traveling the globe and kind of meeting people and discovering all these interesting brands and bringing the stories to people.
You travel a lot. Just so Dave Hammond, you and I met in the Virgin in St. Croix on one of these press trips. I met Hudson in Portugal. As I was one of the very first people to ever go from the nonstop, it was the first nonstop flight from Chicago to Portugal, and I was on that, met Hudson, and so you got an opportunity, and now he takes it a step further. He doesn't just go there, experience it, write about it. Like, you actually have a house there, right, or at least a condo in Portugal?
Yeah. We have a condo not far from one of the spots that you and I visited when we were in Portugal. And my wife and I, we've had one there for 6 years now. So we try to spend a couple months a year, usually in the summer, spring or summer, in Portugal, enjoying it.
Yeah. And here's the thing, too. David Hammond just got back from Mexico, and so he was dealing with some of the cartel things. Like, he's a brave traveler. He always finds out where the hot spots are in the world.
I'm there.
He'll travel there, and, you know, the cuisines of the...
Bulletproof.
Cuisines of Unrest, I think, is the future book that he's working on. Hudson tends to go to a lot of different places. You are in one of the coolest places that is, just because I think the distance that a lot of people, they've all heard of it, but they don't get to go there. Tell us where you're at, Hudson, right now.
You know, right now I'm actually sitting in Queenstown, New Zealand, looking out over the lake in front of me and the mountains in the distance, which were literally the Misty Mountains in Lord of the Rings. They filmed all of the Lord of the Rings movies all across New Zealand, and I've been quietly searching them out over the last month.
When we come back from the next break, which is coming up in a minute or so, we're going to hear about some of the things that you've experienced, some of the things that you've seen out there on the food and dining side. One of the things I think that may keep people away from New Zealand is just it's very far. How was the travel? Was it the kind of, do you have to get the business class where you're laying there in sort of your own like air apartment or yeah, how was your travel? You and your wife, you went over there, did you? How tough was it to get through that?
Oh, it's pretty easy, actually. You know, we flew out of San Francisco. We jumped on a plane, kicked back, had a nice meal before we got on, dozed off a little bit. We didn't have to do a lay down. It was about a 10.5-hour flight over here, but it wasn't bad. Pretty comfy, actually.
Wow. That's not bad at all. That's not bad. So, David, your thoughts, like, where have you traveled? Have you ever some places where you're like, okay, it's a nice place to go, but maybe not worth the trip as far as how hard it is to get to.
I mean, most places I'm glad to go to, no matter how far they are away. Although we did that Australia trip when I did go there like 10 years ago, we got to fly to California first and then get a plane to Australia. So it's a little bit longer than we're hearing here. But yeah, no, there's not a single place I went. I laughed because one of the most significant trips I had was to that Elvis Festival in Tupelo, Mississippi, which was like, I didn't really even want to go, but when I went, I found it was just such a wonderful gathering of people who love Elvis.
Where are you going to find the really elevated peanut butter and banana sandwiches that you'll find at the Elvis Festival? Can't see all the way to New Zealand. That's why we've got to use the phone, and we've got Forbes superstar and host of Booze News right here on WGN. Hudson Lindenberger, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dane. Good to be back with you guys. I'm happy to be down here and not up in the cold part of the world.
Well, do you have to have that sort of global temperature thing? Because, you know, it really does vary, right? Sometimes it's, you know, it's warm in one area and cold in another. Do you try to avoid bad weather, or do you just see it as, you know, it's part of some of the, I mean, if you go to Antarctica or something, or Alaska, I don't know if you could avoid it.
I'm fine with that weather. My wife's not that big of a fan. Her goal is to never see winter the rest of her life. So that does aim our travel.
So Hudson Lindenberger, your next book, Running from Winter, the Hudson Lindenberger story. gotta stay ahead of it. So talk about what you did. You have a plan when you went down there? And I know obviously on the food, on the spirit side, of course, mostly, did you have a plan of places to see? Are you letting sort of some of these things come to you?
You know, pretty much a plan, like kind of sketch things out. You know, we travel a lot. We try to spend about 6 months of the year outside the United States traveling. So when you do that, you got to kind of plan in advance. You can't just shoot off your hip. You know, we're not staying in hostels and stuff like that. We like to book Airbnbs and stuff. So, you know, I kind of go in with a plan. You know, when we were in Tasmania, I really wanted to kind of dive into their culture. I've heard great things. The Tasmanian winemakers and whiskey makers are winning huge awards, like international awards left and right. So I wanted to find out when we were down in Tasmania what made that special. And then in New Zealand, I mean, everyone knows about New Zealand and their wine, but they're also really doing some pretty fantastic stuff with their gin here, too. So same story, just kind of meeting people, diving in, and finding out what they're doing, what makes it tick over here.
Hey, Hudson, I got a question for you. This is David Hammond. couple of years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, we were in Yucatan, a state in Mexico, and we came across this distilled spirit that is made with honey. It's called Shtabintun, and it had a great, it had a very amusing backstory. Allegedly, it's made from flowers that grew on the grave of a prostitute with an honest heart, or some, you know, some elaborate legend like that. And I really dig stories like that, even if they're not true, and I'm sure a lot of times they're not. But my question to you is, in your travels, I mean, you know whiskey and tequila and mezcal and gin and all of that. Did you come across any distilled spirits that are relatively unknown in the United States? That is, maybe they're distilling it from a fruit that's only available in one part of the world, or there's some aspect of the process that's different than the way we distill spirits in the United States. What weird things have you come across?
You know, you bump into some stuff out there and things that you drink that are interesting. I can't think of a really weird one off the top of my head right this moment. But, you know, what I do find when I talk to these people is really interesting in different ways that they're making spirits and doing some stuff. You know, like when I was down in Mexico not too long ago, I was at El Tequileno, and they do an open ferment of their tequila. But what really makes their ferment interesting is they have a bunch of mango trees next to the distillery, and they do natural fermentation, and they're like, it all comes from the fruit flies that come off of the mango trees, and like just the, all that goes in, and they're like, that's what really gives us our flavor. Like, if we move our distillery away from the mango trees, it won't be good. It's kind of fascinating hearing that. You know, you're thinking mango trees and fruit flies, but it works.
Wild.
Oh,
wild.
Man. Oh, okay. So, I mean, I guess, right? But it's not the flavor of the fruit flies, right, Hudson? It's
Well, let's get clear on that.
I wouldn't put it past, because David had, there's a, I guess, a raccoon eating fest up in Wisconsin that he's aware of. I wanted to ask you too, because of the internet and of course some of your work as well, being able to share things that you wouldn't necessarily hear about in Tasmania. You found somebody that was making things it's got enough attention, right, where it's been known, appreciated, award winning, but the kind of place to be there in person is really special.
Yeah, you know, Tasmania is fascinating. We spent 2 weeks there on this trip, and you know, most people know of Tasmania specifically from the Tasmanian Devil. Yes, and point it on a map, no one would know. But you know, it's a small island off the southern tip of Australia that's part of Australia, and it has an outrageously great food and dining scene and alcohol scene, and like their wines. One of their wines just was named best white wine in the world at the International Wine Competition.
Wow.
And they're, you know, the one that really blew me away was their whiskey scene is amazing down there. And I bumped into this distillery I'd never knew about called Sullivan's Cove that really shocked the whiskey world. In 2014, it became the first whiskey maker outside of Japan or Scotland to win the world's best single malt whiskey at the World Whiskey Awards, which is one of the biggest ones out there. And, like, it's this tiny little distillery, and if people were like, how are these guys making such good whiskey, and where? Tasmania?
Wow.
What grain do they use to make that whiskey? Is it wheat, just, or what?
No, they use Tasmanian-grown barley. And part of it is, like, when you go, if you ever go to, Dave, have you ever been to Tasmania?
I have not. Been to Australia, never Tasmania.
Put Tasmania on your list. We went there because when we were planning this trip, a bunch of Australians we knew all were like, go to Tassie, mate. Go to Tassie. Mm. Tassie's amazing. And it's kind of a hidden secret down there, but they produce, I mean, it's loaded with wineries, but 90% of the wine never leaves Tasmania.
Wow.
It has a bunch of great distilleries, and like 70% of the liquid never leaves. And 90% of Sullivan's Cove's whiskey never make it out of Australia. But most of it just stays on Tasmania. So everything they produce pretty much stays there. Mm. And these guys, they have people traveling from all over the world. Whiskey heads are going there just to try their whiskeys that they make. And they've been producing since 1994, and they're very slow. And the whole ethos of the distillery is, we just want to make whiskeys that when they're ready, they're ready. We release them. They go great with seafood, and that's all we really care about.
It's the kind of thing, you know, even just having it be one of those things that's scarce or not easy to get, can I kind of add some either value or maybe a little bit of mystique to it, too? Do they see it, you know, Hudson is like this extra attention, the extra awards? Obviously, it allows them maybe to change the price point a little bit, or do they see it as like, well, that's nice, but it's not going to change what it is that we do or how many people can get it?
Yeah, you know, it's what the latter, what you said. You know, they just did a large distillery expansion. And, you know, like a lot of producers would be like, great, we're going to start pumping liquid out. They put it out and they're like, yeah, now we just went from distilling over, you know, 24 hours a day. Now we're just going to distill daytime shifts and everyone have a better life. And we're not going to push more liquid out. They're like, we're going to just make what we have and we're going to focus on it.
Well, you can read them in Forbes all the time. And, of course, Booze News right here on WGN Radio. I know the Tony Salas interview is going to be coming out soon. That one is great, so people should look forward to that. Again, we'll have links up as we let you go. Hudson, where can people go, maybe social media-wise, to keep up with you?
You know what? I'm the easiest human being in the world to find. All you got to do is type in Hudson Lindenberger. And as best I know, I am the only Hudson Lindenberger in the world. So if you type it in, you'll find me. It's not that hard.
What would you do if there was another one? You're like, listen, it's like Highlander. There can be only one Hudson Lindenberger.
You know, it'll come one day soon. Hudson's been one of the most popular names in America for the last 15 years for little boys. If you notice, there's Hudson starting to pop up. I grew up as the only one. Now suddenly I'm bumping into little Hudsons everywhere.
Well, that's for another tale or a Jerry Springer episode. All right, Hudson, we will let you go. Enjoy the rest of
good
your day.
To you.
And thanks for jumping on the show.
Take it easy.
Hey, have a great day.
All right. That's Hudson Lindenberg, the only one, so far, as far as, and I'm doing the air quotes, that we know of, right? So, David, that was great, right, to be able to talk to someone that sort of shares that sense of not only, you know, culinary interest, but adventurism, and I don't know, bravery-wise, if we can include Hudson in that category.
Few approach the level of courage I've shown by visiting Mexico.
Well, be courageous enough to share. Where can people see you? Are you and Monica doing any more of these kind of town halls or things like that? And then where can people go to either follow you or if they've got something they think, you know, is worthy of being added to the list?
Well, I write for the Tribune and National Geographic and whoever else will take my stuff. I'm on Facebook, David Hammond, not an original choice, but it's easy to find me.
There's got to be 14 David Hammonds out there.
Well, there are many. There used to be three in Oak Park, our little town alone. Oh, three man. In Oak Park alone. If by chance you do come across a food that you think deserves to get a Chicago original food that you feel deserves some attention, a food that maybe is only known in your little neighborhood or your part of town, would love to hear about it. And you can contact me at dchoakpark@gmail.com.